the deafest and the baddest host of State of Games.
The deafest. Deaf guest jam. Who's this, the illest? Who's the
This
deaf?
Is the one about getting ill.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, who's the illest?
I didn't even realize that I was making fun of Daryl.
Exactly. We know
who's the one about getting ill. What do you feel about that, Daryl? That's right. He's the illest because he's not here. No one told you life was gonna be this way. The job's a joke, you broke, your love life's the old way. It's like you're always stuck in second gear. When it hasn't been your day, week, month, or even your year.
All right, welcome to the State of Games. I'm Dice Hate Me.
I'm Puppy Shogun.
And I'm Fell Fangirl.
And we are a podcast all about anything and everything related to board and card games. Welcome to episode 113, or as we like to call it, the one about all the questions.
All the questions.
Well, some of the questions. Questions. So anyway, you may have noticed before we get onto that we're missing a certain co-host. And I don't like to name names, but his name's Daryl.
Daryl is the illest.
He is the illest podcast. We've got the deafest podcast host and the illest podcast host. And that would be Daryl. Apparently, Daryl ate some seafood that didn't agree with him, quote unquote. So he's not wanting to record from the bathroom. So.
We appreciate that, Daryl.
Yeah, although there is a mute button, but I'm just saying.
Yep. And, but, you know, stars from, like, the 60s and late 50s that did rock and roll, they all sang from bathrooms.
They did. Well, Prince used to record in his bathroom.
Yeah, see?
There you go.
Best acoustics.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
Well, that's all we have to say about that. So, anyway, hope you feel better. Maybe one of these days you'll want to be on the podcast again. So, anyway, so now that things have settled down from Origins, Game Fair, and Gen Con, we're back to answer some questions and discuss some show topics that you, dear listeners, have submitted to us. But before we get to that, what's everybody been up to?
My name's TC, and I played some games that were just little card games. But before I'll get into that because me and Chris and Daryl, posthumously, I guess Daryl's posthumously, played some games over in Delaware, and they got to play more games because I had to go to work, which I guess going to work is important. But before that, so I had a game night the other night, and I finally got to sit down, and because it's been almost a month since I got with my regular group again because of all the conventions and game design stuff, and we sat down, and I played through some games I hadn't had a chance to play yet. So Ryan from Mayday, which we talked about last time, he handed me a copy of Dead Man's Draw to try out, and I got to play it, and it was much better than I thought it was going to be. Because I was really concerned, because this was a Kickstarter that was on a long, long time ago. We might have even talked about it. I'm not sure.
It's been a while, but yeah.
But yeah, it was a while ago, and it used to be an iPhone app, and I played it on the iPhone, and I was like, how do you go from this to that? And it translates better than I thought it would. So it's kind of a press your luck game. It's really simple. You're just in traditional, I don't know if it's traditional anymore, but it seems to be the way to do press your luck nowadays, is if you draw a card and it has a symbol on it, and then you draw another one and it has the same symbol, you die or whatever happens. But you cash out and you can't get whatever you collected.
Right.
And that's Dead Man's Draw. So you just start drawing off the top of the deck, and if you ever get a second of the same symbol. But each of the suits or symbols do a different thing. So like the cannon lets you blow up somebody else's card, or the key is needed to unlock a chest card. So you have to like keep pressing your luck to try to get a key and a chest. And you can get a bunch of cards doing that. So it's kind of random, but it also just like you don't know exactly when to stop. So it's pretty fun, and it was really fast. It never outstays its welcome because it was like 15 minutes. So we We played it once, gonna play it again, but then we had to jump into something else, which was important, because it was called The Butterfly Garden.
Beautiful. Nobody could ever be afraid of something like that, either.
Exactly, no one could be afraid of butterflies. Yeah, so I played Dead Man's Draw. It was sweet. Better than I thought. So I don't know if it'll be like one of my favorite games, but it's still fun to play every now and then. And they had a weird misprint on one of the on all the player aids. So I think the player aid cards were supposed to be double sided, and they only printed one side twice. So we had to keep the rule book open to a certain page and keep flipping back and forth, because when a symbol came out, you're like, what does this one do again? And just had to check and see. But once you got over that, you kind of figured them out quickly. But The Butterfly Garden, that's a Steve Finn game. The Biblios guy.
Mm-hmm.
And Biblios Dice and Biblios the card game and Biblios the dice game, the board game.
Biblios everything?
Yep. Mm-hmm. And he really likes library games, I guess. But in this game, you collect butterflies. So you go around, you collect your butterflies, and you put them into your own jar. And you can then later turn in your butterflies to I don't know what to gain victory points for fulfilling contracts. I don't know what the contracts are, but somebody out there wants 3 butterflies of a certain color.
OCD butterfly collectors.
Yeah, OCD butterfly collectors. So I didn't get that part, but putting them into the jar is cool because you build up. It's very easy. You bid using the number on your card, and then once you've bid with that card, you all take whatever tableau of cards that have been placed in the center and choose one card in the order of the numbers that you play. So if you play the lowest number, you get to choose first. And then the person who plays the highest number plays last. And usually the higher numbers give you have a lot of butterflies on them. And when you play a card, you then put it into your butterfly jar and can fulfill those contracts. So you might get 1, 2, or 3 butterflies in your butterfly jar. And the wild butterfly, which looks suspiciously like the red butterfly. I would say the only thing that's hard about the Butterfly Garden, because it was, I actually liked it. It was enjoyable. It was fast-paced. Again, both of those games, they didn't overstay their welcome. But the only problem with it was that you really have to get used to the frame, the outside, like the silhouette of the butterfly, because they are really close. Like, there's a red butterfly, a purple butterfly, a slightly off purple butterfly, and a wild butterfly, and they all look
they're all the same size and shape and everything?
I mean, they're not like different sizes, so they're all like the same size, and so that shape difference is what you have to look for. And on the card, it's like off center a little bit, so you're kind of. When you look at them and they're in your jar, it's a lot easier to see. But when you're just looking at the picture, it can be kind of hard to see what's that. And, you know, and I'm not colorblind, but I think this is actually better for people who are colorblind. Because they might be able to see it a little better.
Yeah, they're just like, oh, I'm not paying attention to color. I'll just look at the shape. Yeah.
But I thought it was cute, and and the cards that were good at the top and bottom edges, they felt like real good, right? It was satisfying to play a card and go, oh, this card's really good. So that was kind of fun. But it's got little issues, like I was saying there. So, but and who knows what the theme is. But it was cool. And then, of course, played Spires. Sorry, I'm going through all of mine quick just so I don't have to go back to them.
No, that's fine, because you'll get to chime in a lot of stuff on my list. So,
yeah. So
Spires, what is that?
That is from an up-and-coming designer, and I've talked about it multiple times. And the reason I keep talking about it is because it'll be up on Kickstarter and looking for funding, and then hopefully be in game stores across the nation as a new architectural craze. It's So that's my game, and just getting my game group again addicted to it. So everyone, we played that a few times, and it was really sweet. So
Spires is launching. Is it?
He was saying
2 weeks.
No, a little bit later than that. So really? It was like September, but it's coming up shortly.
Yeah.
So about a month or so.
Sounds good.
So once I get a date, I'll just say it. But
for now,
for now, it just looks pretty, and it looks pretty on the table.
Good.
All right, Jessica.
Yeah.
Fill us in.
All right. One of the games I got to play this week was Desert Island, and this is the sequel to Lifeboat.
Oh, yeah.
And have you guys played it?
I've not played Desert Island. I want to because Lifeboat, of course, is one of my favorite games of all time.
Really?
And, Friendship Breaker, yes. It's
awesome. Well, Desert Island...
This sounds like a terrible time.
Desert Island is actually really different in that, in addition to... The only position that really matters in Desert Island is the first position, whereas in Lifeboat, like, first and last kind of mattered. Because in first position,
definitely
you
mattered.
Drew the cards and you got to draft first. But at the end, if you're in the last position of the boat, they're the propeller. You kind of determined basically who would get pushed overboard and everything. So in Desert Island, when you're in the first position, you get to draw these cards. And they're scavenge cards. And they're where you can get extra points. And then also get tools and medicine to help you. And first aid kits and weapons, that kind of thing. And that person basically divvies up where everything goes. So you don't even get to draft them. So one thing we did not do, which we probably should have done in our game, was fight a little bit more for first position. Because I think only one person fought for it. And at the end, they had like a bajillion points. Because they just took all the cards that had points.
Well, but, I mean, have you not played Lifeboat before? I mean, there's always the flop. And if this game has the flop, which is the best part of Lifeboat, because, like, halfway through Lifeboat, you're all kind of, like, just feeling each other out. And so somebody who ends up in the front, which is always dependent on the role that you pick, but who's in the front is like, nah, it's fine here. It'll be all right. It'll be all right. And then halfway through the game... The entire boat just turns on each other. Whatever alliances you had are out the window and just all hell breaks loose.
Well, the thing with Desert Island is that all the different positions, basically where you are is you're in different locations around the island and they all have special abilities and some of them are good. So sometimes it's hard to give it up because you have to have food to feed yourself and some of the positions will give you like more food or require you to have less food. Some just give you advantages, so sometimes you don't want to give them up, but then we realized there was the end, like, crap, we're not getting any extra points, so we probably should have fought for that position. At least halfway through the game, or at some point during the game, tried to be in the first position. But I liked it a lot more than Lifeboat, actually, just because the different positions, or the different locations on the island added a little bit to the game.
Yeah.
And the art was really funny, because since it's a sequel... let's see, what are the characters? Lady Lauren, she was pregnant in the photos. And the first mate was carrying a baby. So we're like, where'd he get the baby from? What happened? So, but it was fun. It was good. And I think I do much prefer this to Lifeboat. And I want to play it again and try to play it right and kind of fight for that first position a little bit more.
Well, it's one of those that I wish I had backed on Kickstarter. I kind of missed it. I forgot to hit the reminder button and I should have backed it when I saw it. It's definitely one that I want to pick up. The only difficulty is getting people to just play Lifeboat. Like, I love Lifeboat, but trying to wrangle people, unless you get new people, and if you get new people, you get new people in Lifeboat, they don't want to play with you ever again. But it's one that I definitely want to check out. And I know that it does appeal to some people a little bit more because there's a little bit more structure. Lifeboat's pretty open-ended.
Yeah, very much, yeah.
All right, you want to alternate now? We can talk about some stuff, or do you want to talk about something else?
Yeah, we can alternate.
All right, let's alternate. So, as TC mentioned, I traveled to Delaware last week, and TC came up or down for him for a couple of days. So we were all able to kind of game and try out some different things, and I'll just go ahead and say that one of the games that we played the most while I was there was Mansions of Madness, and... We had mentioned before that Daryl and I got a chance to play this with Richard Launius before it was released because Richard had like his consulting copy and the preview copy. One thing we think, and now I'd have to go back and check my notes, but by playing this version of Mansions of Madness, the one thing that we noted when we were playing with Richard was the dice that he had. We're pretty sure they altered because it was the one thing we said it was like it was sometimes just really too hard to make a skill check and we were getting slaughtered. I think they added an extra success face to the die. I'd have to double check that. But the game felt a little bit more accessible when we played it. But we played every single scenario. And throughout playing it, we realized, you know, two or three things that we were playing wrong, which actually were handicapping us. So we were playing the game on, like, expert mode.
Oh.
And there were two or three different rules. Like, for instance, one of them is you can take two actions on a turn. One of them is move, but you could double up your actions unless there's something like an insanity that's preventing you from doing so. But one thing you can do is if you choose to move, you can actually interrupt your movement with an action. And what we were doing was, well, we would move a space, and then we'd take the action, and we'd lose our other space that we could possibly move afterwards. So there's different things, little subtle nuances you might miss, but at least we played not cheating easier. We made it a lot harder for us. And with that said, we were able to successfully complete, I think, three out of the five scenarios. And two of the scenarios were, like, super hard anyway. And one that we played was, like, the top difficulty level. And Daryl and I made it all the way to, like, the last scene and, like, just lost by a hair. And we're like, oh. But anyway, it's so good.
Is that by design? Do they just, like, probably all of a sudden throw a wall in front of you and say,
no,
you're dead?
No, it was totally our fault because, like, we figured out the mystery that was happening and what was going on in this mansion. And we're like, okay, we've got to, I'm not going to spoil anything, but we've got to do X. And we got to make sure that X is taken care of. And we just, the last couple turns, just threw balls to the wall and just ran for it. And X didn't get protected. And we lost. So it was, you know, but it was really hard to kind of, at the end, balance out, well, we just need to go for it versus, well, we need to do this. And we actually, there's a portion of that. And it's hard to talk about this without giving away spoilers, but there's a portion of that scenario where,
well, each scenario is different every time.
It is
getting that.
You know.
So like the cool thing about Mansions of Madness is it's got the app going on. So like when the app creates the story for you, there's kind of an outline as to what can happen, but within that outline, like they'll just randomly spawn certain types of enemies. Or maybe this time it'll be all like about investigating this crime, and or the next time it'll all be about like an occult worshipping thing. But it all stays within the same kind of framework.
It is true, and that's one of the beauties of what the potential for the original Mansions of Madness could have been, and why this app driven game is so cool, because it is so much about story. And having some replayability without doing new scenarios is kind of tough. And so now the app can change things up. And
yeah,
it's super cool.
It eliminates a lot of the spoiler talk, too.
Oh, absolutely.
You say something, well, it may never happen in your game.
That is very true. I do believe that, like, for instance, the scenario that I'm talking about, I know that there's probably going to be the same basic thing happening. But it'll be different. There'll be different timing, different things that spawn, things like that. But I mean, it's just a great game and experience. It's what I always wanted out of Mansions of Madness, and I'm glad that I got to see all five scenarios. Didn't complete all of them either, but so when I get my copy, of course, I'll be playing through that as well. And what's going to be super cool too is when they start to introduce new scenarios, you're just going to just buy them in the app, and you got all the pieces right there, and it's just going to be awesome. And you also unlock portions of the app and the game depending on if you have the original Mansions of Madness or not, because if you do, there are certain pieces that you can use in the game that will show up that wouldn't normally show up, or I think the one scenario that we did isn't available unless you have the original board game, and if you have some of the expansions to the original board game, then you're going to unlock more and so on and so forth. So I think it's really cool. So I had a good time.
Yeah, so it uses everything.
It does. The final scenario that we did, the hardest one, uses literally everything. It's humongous. So,
well, I, you know, honestly, this is not my type of game, and I enjoyed it.
Well, good.
So, if that's any sort of ringing endorsement, I just the only problem was I just, you know, it gave Daryl the new nickname of Daryl. I read the rules twice, louder. And you're like, hey Daryl. So if I on my turn, can I move and I can do this. How many spaces can I move? Oh well, Hold on, let me check. And since he's not here, he can't defend himself. So, that was a few, but that's fine. It was just silly because he's like, oh yeah, I read the rules twice, and then we were like, so basic question about the game. Hold on, let me check.
Well, and it's funny too.
I think he thought, oh, well, the Apple handled most
right,
of all
right.
of this, so.
And it does. It handles quite a lot of it. But as long as you know, like the absolute like basic, like you said, like how far can you move? Like what's the difference between a ranged and a melee weapon? Stuff like that. You kind of have to know for the app. But the app takes care of almost everything else, including a lot of the combat stuff. You know, marking. I mean, you got to know how to operate the app, obviously. But it marks a lot of the different things. The little subtle ones that we missed along the way, like being able to break up your movement stuff. That's just like any fantasy flight game.
We didn't get the one thing wrong that we were talking about online, right? I mean, that wasn't right.
Which one?
Like the horror checks. Like it doesn't just do one person.
No,
it does.
It has to do everybody. Yeah, okay. Horror checks affect everybody that's within range, but you only have to check against the creature that has the highest horror value. So some people.
Some people are doing everything.
Yeah, and that's just no. Yeah, you'll go insane like in a second. So
well, they need to read the rules twice.
Probably more than twice. And again, like we said, it's a Fantasy Flight game, so there are two rule books. There's the basic one, and then there's the one that has all of the clarifications to what you just read.
This one doesn't need it, though.
It doesn't really.
I think that's,
it doesn't.
Yeah,
really.
it's straightforward.
Yeah, there's only a couple, like putting up barricades and setting fires, and those are really the most complex portions of things you do in Mansions of Madness. So overall,
and barricades don't do anything, apparently.
Oh, they do. Oh, they do.
Whatever. Just break. You put them up, and you go, "Oh, perfect!" And then they spawn behind the barricade, and you're like, "Oh man, my plan worked. I put them behind the barricade. Boom! Doesn't do anything. Doesn't slow
it
down.
It didn't work on in your game, that's for sure. But there was a game we played later that if we hadn't had barricades up, we'd have been slaughtered. So it worked out.
I'm so clever. Nope.
That was just bad luck. All right. So, Jessica, why don't you throw another one out?
All right. I finally got to play my new version of Skull King that I finally purchased, and it's the German version, because there are two different ones. One is the German version, and the other is the Grandpa Beck's version. And I originally purchased the Grandpa Beck's version for my friend for Christmas, and that's how I got introduced to the game and fell in love with it. And it's a trick-taking game, and I've mentioned it before, and it's my favorite game. But the German version has different art. It's a little bit more cartoony, but way more colorful, and I think I like it actually better than the Grandpa Beck's. And there are actually some different cards and different rules. With the Grandpa Beck's version, there are four different colors of cards or suits, and black trumps everything. But then there are pirate cards that trump the black. There is an escape card that acts as a zero, so you're just choosing to lose the hand, lose the trick. There is a Tagris card that can be claimed as either a pirate card or an escape, depending on what you want to do. And then there is the Skull King card, which trumps everything. And that's with the Grandpa Beck's version. And the differences with the German version is that there is also a mermaid card, and she will trump the Skull King if she's played in the same trick as the Skull King. In the other version, the Skull King just trumps everything, but in this instance, the Skull King can be trumped. Instead of a Tigress card, there is the Scary Mary card, which acts like a pirate or an escape. So the biggest difference is just the difference in the name of the Tigress versus Scary Mary, and then the Mermaid card, which changes how things can get trumped. And for some reason, I think I like both pretty much the same. I'm glad I finally have my own copy. Getting the German version to be able to see the differences between the two, but still love that game. Trick taking is probably my favorite mechanic, and this game is probably my favorite game ever.
Ever?
Yeah, it's my favorite game.
Wow.
Above everything, yeah.
That's
It's fun.
Big words right there.
It's got that bidding mechanic, and it can swing the game because of the way it scores. It just makes the game so fun because if you bid zero and you win even one trick, if you're in round 10, you lose 100 points. So you're kind of pushing your luck, looking at your cards, obviously, and trying to, you know, determine if you can get away with winning no tricks. And then, so it gets really swingy with people thinking that they can win zero tricks in different rounds. So
that's cool. I
mean, love it. It's fun.
And have you ever played Spade or Hearts? Spades or Hearts?
I've played Hearts a long time ago as a kid with
okay.
my dad.
All right. So it'd be interesting to at one of these little cons that we go to, maybe breaking out and playing some traditional card games to get your thoughts on them, because, I mean, obviously a lot of the newer games are built on those classics, and just to see how they relate, you know, historically,
mm-hmm.
they're pretty fun. Because, like, you know, just same thing with spades. I mean, you can bid zero tricks. The thing that's interesting about spades, of course, is you're working with a partner. So your partner's got to help, you know, watch your back if you're going to bid zero. And in hearts, you know, of course, you can shoot the moon if you win every single trick, which is always fun. So I'll have to try Skull King, guys. I love trick taking as well. It's just...
It's fun. Yeah, we'll play it next time we get together.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, let's throw out another one. You know, TC, why don't you talk about this one? This is Grim Slingers.
Grim Slingers.
That's right. We're out in the wastelands.
I don't have the flavor text in front of me.
I should go get my box.
Because every single time when you're in the Grim Slingers universe, you got to talk like you got some sort of raspy
gravel in your
southern drawl.
Yeah, that's right.
So I feel like the best person to play this game with is Chris. And it was awesome because I could just play off his southern accent every time I lost my southern accent.
It's true. It's easy to get into it.
But, yeah, and Grim Slingers, it's a game for Southern Americans where you play in the, apocalyptic wasteland, wild west, futuristic world.
Yeah. It's
where
it's a very stylized but fully realized world, for sure.
Yeah, stylized but fully realized. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, because it is extremely one of those like thematic games. I mean, the art brings you in, the writing in it, which I guess is kind of weird to say it from a board game standpoint, but the writing is fantastic. It just it's spot on. It kind of reminds me of, like, if you took some of the tropes that they tried to use in Firefly, and mixed it with, just gave it even more of that grimy Wild West flavor.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Because you have at the beginning, so I guess there's two modes, but let's just I'll talk about it forever, because even though we played all these different games, this was the most memorable for me, just because in Delaware, and it's probably the most memorable I've played in a while. Not because it's good, and not necessarily because it's bad, but because it exists somewhere where it's like just crazy.
It is. It's different.
It's different. So here's the thing. So first thing first, the rule book was impenetrable for multiple people. Like, we were like, I guess, Chris, your story is that you were doing this like at Gen Con, trying to learn it, thinking it was like a thematic card game. You could get into it, figure it out pretty quickly.
Right.
And, or at least let's do the duel part. 'Cause there's a part where you play against each other, and then there's a part where you can do co-op. And you're thinking, oh, well, it's like a 15-minute duel. I can probably figure this out real quick. And I jumped into it. And then so you had problems at Gen Con. I jumped into it. I mean, it was a while before I could figure this game out. I think I picked it up and was looking at the rule books just kind of casually. And it took me to the end of that night and into the next day to figure the game out. And the problem is, because you have this whole solo, or not solo, but this whole duel section, and then you have a co-op section in the rulebook, and it's almost like split in half. But to be perfectly honest, the duel part is so bland that you could pretty much just rip that whole first part off the off the book and throw that part of the game away. And that's probably like the worst thing to say to a game designer or artist too, which game designer and artist for this game, it's all like the same thing, like a passion project. But the problem is you need to know, but you can't, because you need to know all that stuff in order to play the co-op version. And oh man, it was just, I posted on Twitter about bullet points, but I'm not just talking about like specifically bullet points. I'm just talking about like rules that read like lists of rules, and then just trying to figure out interpret what the artist meant by this.
Oh yeah, it was definitely
the reading
that,
the rules
yeah.
was like looking at a piece of modern art. What do you think?
What do you think this means?
This means
right.
Case in point, there was like so. Anyway, whatever. So the duels thing, I would say to anyone who's thinking about playing this game, the duels part is almost, if you do try it, I think you'll try it once and go, whatever. That is whatever. Yeah.
And the fascinating part of me buying this game was I bought it because of the duels.
Yeah, because you're like, oh man, I'm a Grimslinger. I'm like I'm empowered by this witch, and I've got these superpowers, and we're going to fight it out like Wild West style.
Yeah, though, man, this is going to be awesome.
Yeah, and so you get a hand of spells, and you can get some equipment that you can use, but then you just like, okay, well, I guess I cast this spell, and it deals 2 damage, and this other thing. And you go, okay, well, yeah, I cast this spell, and it deals 2 damage and does this other thing.
Yeah, if you're looking to play Wild West, if you're looking to play Wild West Magic, you're out of luck. So
yeah, heck no. Heck no, I say. But the co-op thing actually comes with a booklet, so a separate set of things. And like in that booklet is like this storyline, and you play through the entire storyline that's set up in 5 different campaigns. And each of those campaigns probably going to take you about 60 to 90 minutes. So you got 5 different campaigns that you can go through. And that part was rich and fully detailed and had all these cool things. And still, I don't know, but Chris looked at it for a second, but if I hadn't just, like, sort of intuited how these, as we played, we intuited how it worked, but there was just, even the basic way to play that is so weird.
Yeah.
Like, it says to, like, read the passage when you get there, but then it tells you to double back to the beginning if you've already read that passage.
I didn't understand that whole process. It was, like, backwards.
There was, like, this 3-part step to your turn, but, like, that's all the steps were backwards. So you were supposed to read the thing first, then see if you were at the location, then maybe go back and read it again, then... If you read it correctly, it would be an infinite loop of just reading the same page from the rule book. But we can't do that. So, yeah. So, but getting over that, if you get over all these weird rule problems and you just sit down and play it and you kind of intuit what was meant by the rules, you get this really interesting game that, like, you're fighting these things as you're going on this apocalyptic wasteland. There's a map that you're moving along. When you get to a location, you might get to read something. We had the something pit.
I can't remember the name of it now. It was like
pit of despair,
pit of pain,
the pain pit. But we had this arena battle, and we could press our luck to try to like kill this big creature, and if we did, we'd get like super special bonus, and we did, and it was awesome, and we got all these cards, and they just kept throwing rewards at you for everything that you did, and you would read each new page from the manual in your best Southern drawl, and it was great, and the humor in it was awesome, and I had a great time doing that, but like the actual gameplay, I think, wasn't that strong. It was just the flavor and the theme was so strong.
The theme really shined in this game. And you're right, it was just... trying to just interpret and intuit kind of how to play the game was secondary, of course, to the actual flavor of the game. And once you learned the system, like, you know, you got this little anima, which is a, you know, a little robot companion. And the anima measures... And the way the cards do, they measure out, like, your life points and your magic points or whatever. And the anima tracks that, and then you can kind of recharge or surge, and if you surge, you do extra damage, and, you know, it's a cool little system.
That part was really neat.
Yeah.
Like, we're like, oh, yeah, surge, and you're like, oh, crap, do I want to reload, or do I want to surge again? I liked that decision.
I did, too. It was good decisions to be made in the game, depending on whether, like you said, pressing your luck story-wise or trying to reload / recharge, I mean, / surge. When to use the special items that you get. Like, you and I started out with 2 weapons that were kind of like perfect for our characters, and we held on to them until the very end of the campaign because we were like, we're waiting for that right time to use them, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So my puppy samurai, which legitimately was a puppy samurai.
His name was Cute Kipper.
Yeah, Cute Kipper. Can I has you, if you die, can has I you has boots? You boots? yeah, so that's the type of game it is. It's just, but I will say, so I guess maybe there's some videos online to help out. I tried, like, I just want to put an aside. So I had posted on Twitter and the reason why I will not spend as much time on anything else, because this was the one that, like I said, is the most memorable for me. But, like, I posted a picture of one of the rulebook pages on Twitter, and that's all, you know, it could be bad or good, but, like, the Stephen Gibson, the designer and artist, responded. Was like, to each his own, like, whenever I was being, you know, critical of the rulebook page. But he also, and I responded in my typical way of kind of being kind of not letting stuff go.
Right.
And so I responded back and was like, you know, no, it's not to each his own. I mean, there are problems with this rule book, and they could be addressed, and it would be a better game for it. And I would do the same thing for myself. I have problems with my own rule books. He said that there were some rules videos that you could watch, and I will say this. If you say that, don't ever not have links to them on your Board Game Geek page, because I could not find the videos. I looked for like 5 minutes and then gave up, because I was like, maybe it's on the Kickstarter page, maybe it's here. I don't know. Do I go to their company's website and find these videos, and then which videos am I looking for? I don't know. So make sure you have Board Game Geek links on, because that's where I go.
That's where most people go. And we say all this because we want people to play this game, because
I think honestly the rules, if you got a second edition of the rules, I mean, I think this would be a pretty fun game, and then it just needs a little few tweaks and house rules to help you by, but like, man.
Yeah, I agree. And
such a good world.
I just don't I fear, see, here's the point too, is I fear them, and this happens with a couple of other games as well, people who make them both co-op and competitive. And you can have semi cooperative, and that's fine. So if you want to roll something into it where you got role playing and somebody's a thief or something, and, you know, all of a sudden you got to have a shootout because somebody's trying to steal your loot or whatever, that's fine. But don't, like, because for me, you know, I bought it because I wanted to have a shootout. You know, I'm like, this is Grimslingers. I love the art. I love, like, the universe, and I want to have a shootout. And if it hadn't been for me sitting down with TC and him kind of learning the co-op rules, I would have thought the game was a total failure. Because co-op's just not what I was looking for. But having played it co-op with TC, like, it's a cool game. I like the universe. I like the system behind it. And I would be afraid for other people who might get confused by the rules or buy it based on a certain criteria and not realize that really at its heart it is a co-op and is a storytelling co-op.
Yeah, and it really does shine as a storytelling co-op. And that's what sucks so much, that you make that decision to put both modes in. And yeah, and it's just a hassle for anyone. Like, just you taking the cards and putting them into piles based on what mode you needed for each of the cards.
Yeah.
That was probably the most time-consuming thing, and I'm glad I didn't have to do all of it. And I still had to figure it out, because there were still some cards
right
that weren't clearly marked. And, like, yeah, it's... So, yeah, it's kind of... Figure out what your game wants to be, and then let it be that as much as possible. I'm totally fine that the duels part exists. I just like the fact that they had a separate box for it. That was a cool idea, and maybe it should have stayed at that.
Well, it was interesting too, the fact that they, with the coupon, you could get Grimslinger's Duels for free, and it was a good way to promote the game. But if somebody was to walk into it thinking that's all the game is, I don't think they would buy the bigger game. Even though the bigger game, like we said, it was only $25, and for all of that art and content in that game,
yeah, it's crazy.
It's crazy. It's a great value for if you're looking for a co-op and you're looking for a thematic, immersive co-op, as long as you can get through the rules, then Grimslinger's your thing. Because, again, at $25, totally worth it.
Yeah.
All right. Jessica, let's move on to your next one after we spent 15 minutes on Grimslingers.
How did you like that, Jessica? That was great.
Oh, yeah.
That's our new segment called Chris and TC have a divergent conversation that alienates half the viewers. Listeners.
All right. So I finally got to play my copy of Council of Blackthorn that I picked up at Gen Con. And this game is it's published by Great Northern Games, and it is very much inspired by the King's Council of Game of Thrones.
They make great beans, by the way. Sorry. Go ahead. Jessica
lame.
Didn't like that one. Oh, come on.
So lame. Anyway, so this game is, like I said, inspired by the King's Council of Game of Thrones. So there are various... Everybody plays a different character, like the Minister of Coin is one of the characters. And there are four factions in which you're trying to improve your influence, and you're trying to gain the most influence. But when that occurs, that kind of makes you a target for treason points. So other characters will try to play their cards in order to give you treason points. And there are some instances in which if you play certain cards or take certain actions, you'll gain a lot of influence, but you'll end up earning yourself treason points. But what's cool is that the deck of treason points, all the cards range from 0 to 3, so you could possibly just be drawing 0 treason, and it doesn't affect you. The game kind of reminds me, there's some dice that affect the gameplay and how you can use your cards, the way I feel like it does in Bruges a little bit. Each round, you roll these dice, and they're different colors that match to the four different factions. And if you play a card of that color, the die value will dictate how you can use the cards. There's some instances where when you play the card, then you get to move up as many pips on the die on that faction. It goes all the way up to 13. The height of the influence you can gain in that faction is 13. But if, for example, the die is a 0, then you do something different. You don't actually go up in influence, but you perhaps get to do what's written on the card, even if you don't have the prerequisite. Some of the cards will say you have to be up this high on a specific faction in order to take the advantage of the written text on the cards. And then if the highest pip value is a 3, and then in that instance you don't get to take the action on the card, but you do get to go up 3 on the faction, but you also have to draw a treason card. So the die values will affect what you can do, and so that'll change each round, and so there's a little bit of luck in terms of that. There's also some luck in drawing the cards that you get to use. And there are lots of instances where if you can tell somebody's earning a lot of treason points because you see them drawing little tokens with the points, and you'll see that they're getting a lot each round, and you'll be playing your cards in order to give them some of your treason points to get rid of some of yours, or to make them draw more. And at the end of the game, whoever has the most influence points wins, unless they were the person that had the most treason, because they first get beheaded, and then after that, the next person with the most influence wins.
Jeez, that's violent. Yeah.
It's super, super cutthroat, super backstabby, and so much fun.
See, I don't understand you.
Yeah, I don't understand your preferences.
I don't either, because you're like, either. You hate all that other stuff, and like, this sounds amazing to me.
And for some reason, this game was fun. Well, it might have been I played with my three best friends in my game group, you know, so we don't care if we're backstabby to each other, you know. And but it was fun, and I think the production quality of the game is actually really good. Only thing I don't like are the card backs of the faction cards. I just don't feel like it matches the rest of the game, but everything else I really like. But it was fun, and it took us a little while to figure out how the dice worked and how to play the cards and stuff, but once you get the hang of it, it was fun. It was a lot of fun.
Once again,
I for this game.
You're a wild card. I don't get it. No, I don't like negotiation and social games and backstabbing and all this game's amazing.
I don't know. I think there's a combination of mechanics that, I don't know, maybe for some... Well, there's no negotiation in this game.
Well, I was just throwing out things you don't like.
But so because that's not in there, that might be why I like it. I don't know. It was fun. I can't wait to play it again, actually.
Well, I want to play it. It sounds amazing.
And it plays up to 6. We played 4 players, so I can't imagine what it's like at 6.
But there was a
little bit of like, well, you can tell they're getting all these points, so, you know, give them some of your treason points or whatever. So there's a little bit of that.
So was it like you scored points for each of like the factions individually, or was there one faction that was like the winner?
No.
And if you had the most?
as you go up the track, the factions, there's point values for each level that you're on, for each faction. So there's they actually comes with a paper pad for you to add up your score at the end of the game. So during card play, you'll earn points. So in each round, let's see, you pick cards you're going to play. Every character also has a special ability. So you can either, at the beginning of the round, you can either take your character ability or any buildings you've built. You can pick one building's ability to take. Then after that, you play a card and you resolve the dice for that card. And then you do the action of the card if you can. And then after that, then you kind of score points. So at the end of your turn, you always earn points if you are the highest in any of the factions. And you just go around all four factions to see who's highest. And if you personally are, then you earn points. And then if you're tied with somebody, you also earn points. And then if you have the most buildings at the end of your turn or are tied with the most buildings, then you also get points too. So each round, you're earning points. You also earn points sometimes by playing certain cards. And then as you go up in factions, each one's... I think when it goes all the way up to 5, it goes from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Then after 5, it goes up to like 7, 9, then 13 points. So you just add up your total score at the end of the game for how high you got on each faction. There's point values for those. Then you add all the points that you earned during the game. And then that's your score, yeah.
I didn't know if one was, like, the best or not.
Yeah, no, right. They're all the same. The different cards, though, the one thing I will say about the game is you really have to pay attention to the cards, because you'll have a card maybe that has a great ability that you want to use, but it tells you that you have to be up a certain level on a different faction. You have to keep track of the factions, because there's symbols that show you which faction they're talking about. And they're all different, but then you keep thinking that it's the faction for the color card that you're using, but it would be actually for a different colored faction. So you have to pay attention to that. So a lot of people were like, oh, shoot, I'm not high enough on this one, so I can't use it. And so you really have to pay attention to that. But it was fun. It was so much fun.
All right, I'll have to check that one out, because that sounds right up my alley.
Yeah, I'll bring it with me next time we're together and we can play it.
All right. Well, we got the Unpub Mini in October, and then we got the marathon. So one of those times. All right. Well, let's move on. We're not going to spend as much time on Vast, the Crystal Caverns, as we do on Grimslingers, but TC was able to play that with us. And so Vast was a Kickstarter campaign about a year ago, and they just released it at Gen Con, and I managed to pick up a copy there. Ken got me the copy. I need to PayPal him the money. So, sorry, Ken, if you're listening. I'll get you that money here in a little bit. I'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a Vast, the Crystal Caverns today. Anyway, so Vast is interesting because it is an asymmetrical game in that everybody plays a different faction in the game that has a different agenda. So, for instance, TC played the dragon. And his mission in life was basically to wake up and to escape the cavern.
Yeah.
And, of course, during that, of course, he wants to kill as many goblins as possible.
Because I eat them, and that allows me to wake up more. So there's three, for me, there was three different things that would help me as the dragon wake up.
Right.
And so if I ate some people, or if I... All right, well, I'm blanking. But there were three different things that I could do, and I could only go up those three tracks one time each turn. So there was different ways that I could trigger it, but if I ever got, I think it was 11 of those cubes, I think eventually it counted out to being 11 or 12
something like that,
of those cubes, I could awaken, and when I awaken, I become like visible to the knight, and then have to rush to the exit.
Right. You come out from underground, because normally, like, as you as the dragon...
Even though we're in a cave,
it's a little weird. It's a little weird.
Which is kind of interesting. Yeah. But, like, it kind of inhibits my movement a little bit, too. And I just got to rush, pretty much get to the exit before the knight can kill me. So
right. And I played the knight, and my job, of course, is to slay the dragon. That's my entire job. I went into the caverns to find the dragon and to slay the dragon. And because the dragon is underground, the only way I can hurt the dragon until the dragon surfaces is with bombs. And so I have to go and try to get near the dragon, set a bomb, and hopefully hurt the dragon. And in the meantime, I'm trying to dodge attacks from the stupid goblins, because the goblins' entire reason for living is to attack the knight who has come into the castle, or the dungeon, or the cave, whatever. Cavern, excuse me. And then, of course, so I was the knight, Leslie played the goblins, and Daryl played the cave, which is the most interesting thing ever, because we talked about this when it was on Kickstarter, and TC was like, I want to play a game where you get to be the cave. Yep. And it was pretty cool. The cave, of course, Daryl's drawing tiles, and then he gets to construct the cave, and the cave is hidden. Parts of the cave are hidden until I move into a certain spot and illuminate it, or until TC uses his like flames to illuminate parts of the cave. So there's a lot of hidden information, and the goblins can use the shadows of the hidden parts of the cave to travel around and stay kind of safe. And they get different powers, too, as far as, like, monsters that they can enlist in their aid that give them special abilities. And they're the whole time, they're basically just trying to take out the knight. And it was really an interesting game. You can play up to five. There's also another character that I recommend you only play with five players, and it's the thief. And the thief is trying to get as much loot as it possibly can, things like that. But we didn't play with the thief, so we just had those four. And I will say that Leslie started out super strong with the goblins. Like, in the beginning, it was really easy. And there were a couple of rules that we missed in the beginning. So after the first two or three rounds, we saw that, okay, well, this should have happened differently versus this. And so, obviously, in a learning game, that's going to happen. But but overall, it was like Leslie started out super strong as the goblins, because she was able to traverse the shadows pretty easily and start pinging at me and got me down to about half of my life. And then TC started ramping up, because as the dragon eats more goblins, it gets more powerful. So he's getting more things. And then as the knight, I was just trying to explore and smash crystals and get upgrades and things like that. And then I finally realized, well, I need to start hurting the dragon, or the dragon's going to wake up. So then I started chasing down TC. And the whole time, Daryl's, as he puts out bits and pieces and he collects things from a bag, there are these tokens that are from a bag. He can use those tokens to activate various abilities in the caverns, which was pretty cool. And then, so TC looked like he was going to win. What was interesting about the cave is, like, TC looked like he was going to win, so he was getting a little bit of head. So the cave would, Daryl would enact, like, the spores, like there were mushroom spores in there, and they would weaken somebody. So he weakened TC a couple of rounds and took a couple of his cubes back and whatnot. So the asymmetrical portion of it was pretty neat. It seemed fairly balanced, because TC was about to win, Daryl was about a turn away from winning, and I had one last thing that I needed to ping TC with, and so when it became visible, I was able to go and hit him and win.
Yeah, it's tough. I would say the only part that would be tough for the dragon is, like, revealing yourself is really tough, because once you're revealed, then the knight can just start attacking you.
Right.
So you do want to be, like, super powerful when you get there. And I think it just, you know, from a learning game perspective, I probably would have done things slightly differently had I known how badly the knight could get me.
Right.
but at the same time, like, it was kind of interesting that all the asymmetrical things kind of came together and it worked out the way it did. I would say, for anyone playing the very first time, you're not going to have as much fun playing as the cave if you've never played the game before. Yeah. I think just because if you make mistakes at the beginning, it can seriously affect the cadence of play for the cave, because it's got to get all its tiles out before it can start doing its crazy stuff. And I think we kind of cut Daryl off by a turn or two for his ability to cave in on people, because we didn't explore enough.
Yeah.
So keeping that in mind, I would say, though, the reason why as much as I enjoyed playing it, I don't think it's a game for me, but I think the reason why is more based on the fact that I'm doing my own thing, but I'm just keeping each other in check. It's one of those games where you have to keep each other in check. And I just am, as I play more games, I'm just not as interested in the keeping each other in check.
Policing the board sometimes can get tiresome.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's not to say that other people will not be. I think a lot of people will have a huge amount of fun playing this game, and I'm not going to like turn it down or anything. I think it's good. It's just that because of the learning curve and because of the other things, you may not, even though you want to be the cave, you may not have as much fun the very first time you play it as the cave. You might have to wait on that one.
I would agree. And every single faction has a different nuance to it. I'll be honest with you, as the knight, I was probably the most straightforward. I was pretty much doing most of the exploring slash doing different things like that, but it was all very straightforward as the knight. The goblins have nuances with the different cards that they draw every turn. You as the dragon, you have different nuances as to what you unlock and how many different types of things you can do. The cavern has a lot of nuances. So as you play the game, you're right, as the beginning game, it's going to be a little different and difficult. But if this is something that, especially, I mean, the art's super cool and the feeling of the game is cool. The production quality of the game is great. And I recommend you trying it out for sure. I think I agree with you, TC, that it might not exactly be my game. I enjoyed it when we played it, and I wouldn't turn down playing it with somebody, but I don't know necessarily that I'll break my copy out a ton to get to the table. I'd like to show it to a couple more people, of course, but still.
I said like the rules are difficult. I'm not saying that I think the rules were really well written for what they had.
I agree.
Right? Like, it is just a difficult thing to figure out how all the things interact the very first time you play. That's pretty much what it is. But I love that they got everything on like a single sheet of rules, and you really don't ever refer to anything else during the game. And after a few turns, I already knew what everything I could do.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
At least as the dragon.
It's a pretty amazing accomplishment that they were able to do that. And you don't have to alter the fact that I read the rules, the basic rules anyway, and then I just handed everybody their sheets, and all of you, and I explained the basic rules, and then you read your sheets, and we were ready to go, you know?
Yeah.
That was pretty cool. All right, well, let's move on. Jessica, there's this little game called Scythe, I think you played?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did.
Why don't you talk about Scythe?
I played this a little over a week ago, and I'm not entirely sure how I feel about it.
Best game ever.
I love worker placement.
It's dethroned Skull King.
No. I love worker placement games, but for some reason this play of the game just kind of was with me.
I don't know if you call this a worker placement game, but
well,
it kind of is, I guess.
Yeah,
it's two. We call it a 2.5x is what we call it, but anyway.
Why do you call it a 2.5x?
I won't get into that. You can listen to the Geek All-Stars if you want to hear that part, but go ahead.
Well, I really don't know what else to say about it, except I'm not sure how I feel about it. I really want to play it again to see if I'll like it more, but there wasn't too much combat, and one thing I don't like in games is combat. There was only like one battle I had to deal with, but there's so many different things going on, and I just felt like it took me forever to spread out, actually. Like, I didn't have any stars on the board until everyone else had, like, 3.
Really?
And, and mostly, like, my mission cards were terrible.
Yeah, sometimes
it'll
happen.
Yeah, so I had one super heavy combat one. It was, I had to have, like, 8 combat cards and have engaged in a combat to complete it, which I just didn't even pay attention to that card. And the other one was I had to have control over 3 mountain regions, and where my starting position was horrible. So it took forever to do that. And so I think because there are different factions and they all have different advantages, I think it's one of those things where I really have to pay attention to what the advantage is and kind of see how to work around that to, you know, earn the points and complete the different
objectives.
Objectives and stuff. Yeah. So,
well, let me ask you, how many players and what faction did you play?
4 players.
Okay.
And I don't know. I was the white one. I don't know which one that was.
The white one.
It's got lions, right?
I don't remember. It was super late. We started the game, I think, at 11 p.m. And we were all learning, except for one person. No, except for 2 all people.
So you broke the rule of no new games after 9.
Oh, yeah. They didn't leave my house till like 2 a.m. or something. So
Well,
that's, it's not a, to me, that's not a real rule. That's that's just when things are starting. So.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Well, yeah, all you guys are vampires. My bedtime is 8 o'clock, so.
Well.
But yeah, that sounds like you might want to try again. Yeah. But at the same time, I haven't played yet. Maybe this week I'll play.
It felt like it just took forever to get anything going, but.
Well,
maybe that was just me.
It might have been. And I will say that with Scythe, it depended on your faction, but also depending on your playstyle. Like, my first game of Scythe, I was, like, off to the races. And I had stuff going. I had, like, everything was just synergizing and left and right. It was amazing. And in my second game of Scythe, because I didn't really pay attention to the strength of my faction, I was struggling a little bit as far as, like, getting as many stars as, like, Adam and Dan were. And I'm glad that I played and had that experience in the second game. But I think it really depends on, you know, your setup and your faction. And I guess what you sound like you got some really two bum objective cards, which sucks.
Yeah.
Because if you get some decent objective cards, they can give you something to shoot for. Like my first game, I had some pretty decent objective cards, and it gave me something that gelled a little bit with not only my faction, but also because you have different starter boards. You could have a board that's geared toward one thing over the other in the game. And sometimes those three things together could be totally at odds with each other. So I would recommend you playing it again and getting another opinion on it. Try to play it earlier.
Well, I came in second and I only had 4 stars out.
Really?
Which was surprising.
Wow. Yeah. That's impressive, actually.
Because as soon as I got, it took me a while to get any out, but I think I got 2 out almost back to back. And then the other two kind of was like.
How far up on the reputation track or whatever it's called?
Not very high at all. Really? I wish I had a focus on it. If I had done that, I could have won.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I'd recommend you play it again. I mean, I've made my opinions on my Scythe plays evident when we talked about it on the Geek All Stars.
Yeah.
So you can listen to that as well. But I do recommend you play it again. Cause,
yeah, I want to. I was actually itching to play it again to see if. It's, you know, my opinion of it would improve just after having, you know, gotten the first play in and it having had been so late.
Well, it's also interesting because I want to get your take on it because, like you said, you don't like combat in games a whole lot. And Scythe isn't really a combat game. You can play the whole game avoiding combat, usually, unless somebody's
overly
aggressive.
Yeah, I mean, I was way off to the side. Nobody was really around me, so I didn't have to worry too much about it.
Yeah.
Except when I got, what's that central location where you
can get
the
factory.
Yeah, so yeah. That's the only place I got attacked, really.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think it may not just be the game for me, but I want to give it another shot to see.
Yeah, you should. So we'll check back in on you next time you play Scythe.
All right.
So let's talk about really quickly. We're going to start moving through these because we're at an hour and we haven't even got to the meat of the podcast. But we played a lot. But TC and Daryl and I played a really interesting pressure luck game. And TC, you were talking about pressure luck earlier, which is interesting for Celestia. Yeah. And so
this was a surprise. It was a surprise hit.
Totally. It was a really cool game. And the production quality is awesome. The art is beautiful. You get to fly around this little airship and everything. I mean, it was just... It was a ton of fun, and it was far better than I expected it to be.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
I mean, and just as a real quick thing, so it's like a reimagining of Cloud9 from the same designer. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, for some people, that's a game that people know. So I never got a chance to play it. But it's basically the idea that you're moving forward with your airship to different areas, and the only way to get to the next area is for the captain to steer you there. And the captain has to play cards from their hand with symbols. And those symbols are on the dice as well. And each time you move to a new thing, you roll the dice, you see what symbols are there, and then everyone decides if they want to get out and leave the captain to his own, like, demise, right? Or if they want to go down with the ship, which, I mean, okay, go to the next area, but usually go down with the ship.
Right.
So... Any time, like for me, it was always like you would see, like you'd roll the dice and you'd be like, ooh, he just got wing and
lightning bolt
and,
or whatever.
Lightning bolt, okay. So I don't know. He could have that. But as the game goes on, I had a wing problem. Yeah, I had. I think it was wings problem. So anytime a wing would come up, everyone would be like, "Oh no!" And it's all on like whether or not you think I drew in the last turn or two, like a red wing.
And you want people to jump out. Like there's not like a lot of social aspect. But every now and then you're like, "Oh well, do I have that?" You know, I'm just kind of playing around. You know. And then
it's just a little bit of bluffing, like as in, oh yeah, this is easy, or no, this is I'm never going to be able to make it. Like everybody just, you know, you might as well just get out now. Yeah.
And the cool part of it too is like, so when you jump out, each individual when you move up, not every single one, but you're going to be adding more and more dice to the pool, so it gets harder and harder. And also, there's a score range with each of the individual buildings or the places you visit. So the further you get along, the more you could possibly score. But if people jump out, then they get a card from that stack that could be, like if it's a third level, I think it's like up to 6 points or something like that. You never know.
Yeah, but all of them have like, it's 6+.
6+, right?
You get a card and it could be more than six.
Yeah, it could be a lot. Or it could, yeah.
Yeah, it could be a lot, and then you know whenever the round is over, if anyone has 40 points, they go, "Ah, I have 40 points," and the game's over, and whoever has the most points wins.
I think it's 50.
So,
I think it's 50.
Oh, it's 50. Yeah. Okay,
but it's close.
Certain amount of points, right? And then you flip over, and I was surprised by it because all those things make for a really cool mini bluff. I guess there's a mini bluffing aspect to it, in general, it's just kind of, when do I want to go? Do I want to keep going on this? Do I want to get out? What do I think? How far can we go? And most of the time when you get out, you feel good for getting out because everybody just dies.
Right. And this is definitely one that I want to pick up for my collection. And I don't say that very often anymore because I'm surrounded right now by games. If there was an earthquake, I would die because there's so many board games that surround me. But this is what I feel like I could put on my A-team shelf because I could break it out with a lot of different play groups. It's ones that I could take as sort of a filler if we want to play between something else. And it's just the production quality plus the actual fresh, not necessarily fresh because it's a retake on an old game, but a sort of fresh take on Pressure Luck that's a little bit different than others. This is one I would highly recommend to people. And it's not very
expensive. Plus, you could have an Airships night.
Oh, absolutely.
Airships theme game night.
We play Celestia, then Giganten der Lufti, and then, then we're all set.
And then we're out.
Then we're out.
And we all go home.
All right. Tell us about Creo, Jessica.
Well, I mentioned this last time.
Yeah, it's gorgeous, right?
Yeah, it's really gorgeous. It's a cooperative, small little card game from Cool Mini or Not, in which you're trying to work together in order to build a planet, basically. But basically what you're doing is you have to lay down certain cards in a certain order and then complete those cards before you can start the next level of cards. And you have to do that without knowing what cards are in other people's hands and without talking and giving hints and waggling eyebrows at each other about it. So I've been playing this game so much more, and I'm loving it more and more the more I play it. And there are advanced cards and special abilities and things with the game, but I'm still, like, so... I still have not played this game in the true spirit of the game, where you're not giving hints and discussing too much. So we don't want to play with those advanced cards until we actually have played in the true spirit of the game, like a real full game. For some reason, this game is really hard for me to teach. I feel like the first game you play with people has to be kind of just a practice game just to see, so they can see why certain cards need to come out in a certain way and why, how you think a person before you might be playing, because turn order is really important. And then immediately after playing the game, because it can be pretty short, you just play another game and you try to play more to the true spirit. But even then, we're still kind of giving hints and discussing things. So I want to play one game, and there's actually a variant in the rules where it says complete silence, and you're just like, don't say anything. And I kind of want to do that to see if we can really, really play it like that without giving hints to each other.
Hey, there's a similar card to that in Mansions of Madness, but I won't spoil it for anybody.
Yeah. But yeah, so been playing that a lot. Love it. And I've realized I don't really like cooperative games that much. But for some reason, these ones where you don't know what cards everybody has and can't talk about it, I like that stuff better. A little bit of hidden information
for like
everybody else.
Playing Hanabi or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is, you know, it's a game.
It's awesome. Amazing.
It's as much of a
Build-A-Jar winner.
It's as much of a game as the game, so.
It's great. Yeah, it's great. Don't listen.
Well, TC will be talking about Hanabi a little later, if we ever get to that portion of the podcast.
Hey, you know what else is a game?
What's that? Vikings on board. Sure is. It's a game. That's all we're going to... Matter of fact, that's
Sassy
probably
Viking.
All we really need to say. We don't need to go into...
It's a game. We played it.
We played it.
Nuh-uh, really?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Oh, no.
Yeah, unfortunately.
But they were hating on it. I actually think I liked
TC
it.
TC had the most fun of everybody.
Okay. But I was doing everything I should. I was betting. So in the game, you're Vikings or something. I don't know. And you're putting things on boats, and sometimes you ship things on boats, and it's all worker placement, and they move out and just the sea and whatever. But what you could do was you could bet on which color you thought would have the most shields on the boat. Mm-hmm. And whenever they have the most shields, they get first pick of good stuff. So I just started placing bets on things and then hedging my bets on things. And I liked that part. I liked that people were like, oh, crap. You know, I like that you just piled on anytime someone wanted to do something. Like, I forced Chris into a situation where he was like, I can't do anything good for me and I have to ship a boat and and I go last and I only benefit TC.
Yeah, right.
And that's the best kind of decision that I can create in a game, is when Chris has to benefit me and he has to choose which one's best. greatest game ever.
And I did the exact opposite, because I was like, I'm never going to win a bet. So I just kind of focused on trying to get the most goods and then driving those goods up in the market. And I ended up winning, but
yep.
I had the most miserable time of everybody.
I know.
Yeah, because I was just like,
no, it's just,
I was like, none of my choices matter. I mean, I can do little tiny things hoping they end out in the end, but every single thing I wanted to do was thwarted by somebody swapping something or TC forcing me into a corner where I have to ship one of his things so he gets points or whatever for a bet because it makes the most sense. It was just absolutely ridiculous.
I was trying to make a deal. I was like, I'll give you this option and then we can both benefit. And he's like, I don't know about that. And I'm just like, okay, you're screwed.
Right,
help me
exactly.
out.
Exactly. Yeah.
Great. Great game. But no, it's a game. We don't need to talk about it anymore.
Okay.
And that's about it.
Yeah, unfortunately, I wanted to like this game, but no, it was miserable. So, yeah, but great production quality though.
Yeah, the Vikings are amazing. Yeah,
the little sassy Vikings.
I didn't pick it up.
That's right. All right, Diamonds the Thief, Jessica. Let's move through this.
All right, I played this this week, and it's really cool the way that the expansion changes the game. So, in Diamonds, when you play the club's off suit, you get to steal a diamond from somebody else, or if you win a diamond, win a trick that was led with clubs and you get to steal from someone. In the original game, you could steal from anyone you wanted, so you basically ganged up on the person who you felt like was winning the game. But with the expansion, you can only steal from the person that has the thief token in front of them. As soon as a club action is taken, then the token moves to the person to the left of that person, so it's always moving around. So it's cool because, like, for example, if you have the token in front of you and you're like, I need to get this thing away from me so that nobody steals from me, you can either, you know, start the trick with clubs and hopefully win it so that nothing is stolen from you, but the token still moves. Or you can play it off suit against yourself before somebody else does, and then you can move the token before someone can steal from you. So that's an interesting choice that's there. And I'm still terrible at this game. I still lose almost every time I play it, but I still love it.
Yeah, I love Diamonds. It's just a great game.
Another great trick taker.
Yeah, definitely. And Mike Fitzgerald, who's a designer, I mean, he just did a fantastic job. And we played this 2 years ago with him at Gen Con. And it's one of those that you can just bring along with you in case you want to break out and play a game like this. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that the thief exists too, because you can. It basically exists to prevent collusion. And I think it was a smart thing to do. And Bonacore was funny about it too, because he admitted himself. He's like, I brought these along, you know, and we started talking about it the first day of Gen Con, and he's like, well, you know what this is, right? And I was like, it's just a representation of something you could do. He's like, yeah, you could use your iPhone, you can use a quarter, use whatever. He said, but I'm producing these blocks that have a thief on it, you know? And I'm like, yeah, but people like that. I mean, it's thematic, you know? So it's really cool. So, okay. So I'm going to be brief about this because I'm going to be brief about all the other ones that I mentioned, but I don't want to get too deep into Cry Havoc because Daryl's not here and I need backup on this one. because I don't know. Okay, so Cry Havoc, obviously most of you out there have heard of Cry Havoc. It was like the darling of Gen Con, and Tom Vassell mm-hmm. has gone freaking nuts about it, and everybody's been talking about it. And I've been following this game for 3+ years as Grant Rodiak has been working on it in development. At any rate, it's an asymmetrical play. Again, another game that has asymmetrical play. It's a battle game at its heart. It's a strategic battle game, and you're trying to gain objectives in this on this alien planet, and every single faction plays a little differently. The reason why I mentioned Cry Havoc now is because Daryl and I, in order to try it out and test the system, played it 2 players. And I talk about this a little bit, well, probably more than I will right now, on The Last Geek All-Stars. And the problem that I have with the game is that it is not a two-player game at all.
I mean, it's probably true. Most people, whenever you say that, are like, oh, well, why would you ever play it with 2 players?
Yeah, because it says 2-4 on the box.
I know, but it happens, right?
Yeah,
I know. With the best games, and yeah, which I can totally see. I mean, it seems like a game where you are controlling different areas, and then you put people in a lineup, and like depending on how they come out, like that's the order of operations
right.
for like fighting,
right.
and that does not seem like a very good that does not seem conducive to 2-player.
It's not. And the problem though is that there are many, many, and I'll call them war games, but games that have conflict in them that can still be played at 2 players enjoyably because they have conflict. But the problem with Cry Havoc is that me as the humans, part of the conflict comes in me interacting with Daryl, who played as the machines, but also the fact that there's these indigenous life forms called the Trogs, which in a 4-player game, somebody actually plays them, but they have these little nests and war parties and stuff that are set out and seeded at the beginning of the game. The thing is, for me as the humans, I had an ability that I could just take over a couple of areas and then use airfields, which is a construct that I could put out into a place that I controlled. And then I send airships into adjacent things and exert control and put control markers down without having to engage the Trogs. There was nothing in the rules that said I had to engage the Trogs with that. It just simply said place, you know, X and Y, and I looked up and got all the clarifications from the rules, at least the rules the way they were written, and even Daryl and I stopped and said, this seems broken, what's happening? And so we went and literally like took 30 minutes looking through the BGG threads, any FAQs, all those different things to see if we were playing it wrong, and we could not find anything that contradicted the way we were playing. And I literally almost lapped Daryl on the score track. And that shouldn't happen. And it shouldn't happen in Cry Havoc, because having watched a 4-player game at Gen Con, I saw how tight the scores were. And it was crazy. It was just nuts. And so, yeah, I'm just going to leave it there because, again, I want to play it at a 3 or 4-player count, preferably 4 players, because I think that's really where this game will shine, because you have all 4 players with asymmetrical play at each other's throats the entire game. That, I think, is where Cry Havoc's going to be. But I do not recommend this game at 2 players at all. At least from our play.
Okay.
So, anyway, that's where I'm going to leave it. All right, why don't you round us out, Jessica, and then I'll talk briefly about the other ones that I played. But you played Dragon and Flagon.
I did. This game is published by Stronghold, and it's just a tavern brawl game. It's supposed to be super chaotic with lots of mayhem, and I experienced none of that during this play of the game. What's cool is that you play this game in a 3D environment. So there are these cardboard tables that you set up, and they're really cute because they have like pictures of plates of food on them and everything. And then there are mugs you set on top of the tables. There are chairs you set up next to the tables and spots. There are rugs that are laid out, and they're just, you know, like thin cardstock. And in the game, you use your cards to move your characters, put them into position to pick up items. Like, you can pick up a chair and have it in your hand. There's on your player mat, there's actually a little hand drawn, and you place the chair there so you know you're holding it in hand. And then if you're in a good position against an opponent, in the next turn you can throw it at them and cause damage and basically steal victory points from them. But the way that the cards are played is that you have 2 cards out at a time, and then the turn order is random each time, which is supposed to encourage chaos and mayhem. But because of the way things were playing out, and because you were basically playing a card like two turns ahead, people would like move out of the way. So when I threw a chair, it didn't do anything. Or, you know, I'd be in position to attack somebody and they'd move, so I couldn't do anything. And so like the first three or four rounds, almost five rounds, it felt like nothing was happening. People were just moving around and throwing things, just breaking things for no reason. So that's kind of entertaining as in a brawl, just to see stuff get thrown and broken. You know, if once you throw a chair, it's supposed to be broken and damaged and it's out of the game. But other than that, nobody was getting hurt. Nothing was happening. So our game was kind of boring.
So you're just it was trash in a hotel room.
Yeah, basically.
You should put that into Underground, TC.
Oh, yeah.
You could have a little a trash the hotel mini game in Underground.
A little mini game you just play off to the side.
Hey, you know what? That could combat the downtime between turns. No, I'm serious. Might be onto something there. While everybody else is waiting for everybody else to take the turn, you're trashing the hotel room with somebody else.
The only time our play of this game got interesting was one person had this character that was basically like a ninja. And so they did like a shadow step to where during their turns, they were able to basically pop up anywhere on the board directly behind a character. And for some reason, that worked out for them to where they basically stabbed in the back after being positioned there. And, you know, like the person didn't move before they got their turn. So, but other than that, I almost no points, because we all have a certain number of victory points. And then if you, you know, inflict damage on somebody, they transfer their victory points to you, like 3 or 4 or 5 points to them. And so there was almost no points being like exchanged for the first half of the game. So I don't know if it was just us and just the way the randomness of the turn order went or whatever, but I don't know. It was
that sounds hilarious and terrible.
It's really cute, but
yeah, that's very funny that nothing worked out and you just end up breaking everything in the room.
Drunken hotel smashing the game.
That would be fun.
Well, I'd like to still try it. It seemed like a game that I would like, but if it's just complete chaos and nobody ever does anything, it might be interesting. But it is one that I definitely want to try. It's not one that I picked up from Stronghold. I think that we might be getting a review copy of it, but I'm not sure. But it would be fun to play.
Each character also had special abilities, and I think if you just pay attention to those and kind of focus on those, then there would be a little bit more that could happen. Like my character, I could go first every turn for about 8 turns. And once I put that into effect, then I was able to do a little bit more, but not so much, but still not that much, because people would move and I would still have a card in play that I'd already played that was like worthless when my turn came around. So,
all right. Well, TC, you and I'll get together and play this so you can adapt it into Underground. So I think, mm-hmm. It's definitely worth doing. All right. So I'm going to throw out several titles here really briefly because we want to move on to the meat of the podcast. I'm going to talk about these three first, because if you want to know more about these, you can listen to the latest episode of the Geek All-Stars, which are ones that we covered like hugely in depth in our Gen Con post convention coverage. But we played Unfair, which we'll get to. It's currently on Kickstarter. It is an amusement park building game, which, of course, if anybody knows me, knows that is freaking awesome. And I was so excited about this game. And I played it, and I enjoyed the game a lot. Again, you'll get my full thoughts on it in the Geek All-Stars, but if you are averse to Take That Games, do not play this game. Because
it's called Unfair for a reason.
It is called Unfair for a reason. It's exactly right. It is as advertised. It's a gorgeous production. The game itself has just, the mechanics are rock solid. But the environment of the game itself, you can really get hosed. So listen to my thoughts on the Geek All-Stars about that. Merchants of Araby, which is right up my alley because it has camels and conniving. So it has camels in it, and of course the entire game is all about negotiation. You would hate it, Jessica. But I had a blast. It's currently on Kickstarter as well. We'll mention more of that in the podcast. Again, listen to the latest Geek All-Stars if you want my full thoughts on that one. And Islebound, which is a Ryan Lockett game. And I really enjoyed Islebound. Not as good as Above and Below. I feel like Above and Below is his best. And I've really enjoyed his play of that. A couple of his games have fell short. The Ancient World really didn't live up to the hype for me. But I love 8-Minute Empire's Legends. Just fantastic. Above and Below is a great game. And Islebound, has a lot of combinations of some of his other games. Every game kind of takes some cool things that worked in previous games and adapts it into the game. And I think like the war versus diplomacy route from Empires of the Void works really well in Islebound because it's much more streamlined and it's a much easier game to play. Again, latest Geek All Stars for that. The other three that I'll mention we played at in Delaware was Saloon Tycoon. Played that with Daryl Leslie. Really an enjoyable game. The production value is fantastic, and Van Ryder Games has been putting out some cool stuff lately. The only drawback that I had to Saloon Tycoon was the end game was a little odd, and unless we were playing something wrong, we've ascertained that in a two-player game, if it was just me and Daryl, we probably would have played forever.
Okay.
Yeah, because you only end the game if you run out of the little cubes that are represent posts that fill up, you know, so you can build more floors and things like that. Because of where we stood with each other, we both had something that depended on each other for our end game kind of scenarios, and we knew it. We would have just waited, and neither one of us would have taken the last and end of the game. So it was like it was an infinite loop, which is bad.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But overall, though, then Leslie was the tiebreaker. She decided to, you know, the heck with this and took the last one. But anyway, because of that simple thing and the way things suss out, neither Daryl nor myself could kind of accomplish what we needed to because I had what he needed and he had what I needed and so on and so forth. But overall, though, building up the little saloon and playing, you know, trying to draft cards and getting the certain cards and pressing your luck versus trying to beat somebody else for something and chaining things into extra actions. There's a lot of chance in the game, and that's just you should just know that off the bat because of the cards and the way things suss out. But still, it's still an enjoyable game. I want to play it more. I want to see if that in-game situation happens often. But probably another game that I might not recommend with two. Just simply by the way we saw the way it worked. But as a three or four player game, I think it's going to be totally fine. Played Morocco from the Fleeples, Matt Riddle and Ben Pinchback, one that I backed on Kickstarter. And this game is super cool. It's very easy to play. It has recognizable mechanics. Again, this is what Matt was teasing me because he's like, I got Chris Kirkman to like an abstract game, you know. And I'm like, okay, fine. It's a little abstract, whatever. But, you know, you're still doing something. You're putting people into markets and getting juice merchant points and stuff like that. Yeah, it's totally abstract, but whatever. It was still fun. I really would like to see it with their original theme on it, Flora, which is all about, you know, flowers and things like that, which I thought would have been a totally cool concept, which now we have Lotus and, you know, Kodama and stuff like that, and there's all these different things. If it had been not necessarily a Moroccan market and had been what they originally planned for the game, I think it could have been absolutely gorgeous. Not that this is a bad production either. It's totally cool to play the way it is. It has a little rondel system, and I thought it would be harder to play than it was because you have to draft these cubes and use cubes to cross-check columns and rows to see if the cube matches up, and then if it does, then you can place a certain type of worker in that space. And depending on that worker's space, you could also use specialty workers if you pay an extra cube, things like that. And I thought it was going to be, when I first read through the rules, which are not very difficult, and they're really well done, by the way. Dustin Schwartz edited this rule book, and it's just really nice, really good rule book. Anyway, so when you play the game itself, it's not that hard to understand, but I thought it might be cognitive overload trying to remember what cubes you have versus where you would reference, but it really wasn't. It played smooth. It had great little both tactical and strategic movements to it. I highly recommend it. Again, great production value. Of course, we love the Fleeples, and it's a very solid design. And finally, I'll just throw it out there that I played Milkman, which you've all heard about, but Milkman's from Josh Mills. It will be a Dice Hate Me Games production in the future. We don't know exactly when we're going to release it, but probably either in spring or fall of 2017. So stay tuned because you'll be hearing much more about Milkman.
Awesome.
Yep. And congratulations to Josh. He probably won't hear this because he's busy being a new dad, but congratulations to Josh because they just had their daughter.
Little
Magnolia, which I think is a magnificent name. It's a great, great name. So, well done.
Yeah, sounds very Southern.
Maybe a little bit. All right, that wraps it up for this portion. Let's now finally move on to the meat of the podcast. So like I mentioned at the top of the show, we're going to tackle some topics that you all submitted. And we want to mention that if you do have other things you want us to talk about, please do it, because we plan on doing these types of podcasts on things that you want to hear about, you know, maybe every 3 to 4 months, something like that. But it's totally integral to us that we talk about things you want to hear. So first of all, let's get to our first kind of question / comment. What about money in games? Stuart Falconer was the first person to submit anything to us via email, and his question was, what are our favorite and least favorite game currencies? This is definitely a topic close to my heart. At the time, he'd recently read a geek list on BoardGameGeek.com, and it got him wondering about preferences from a publisher standpoint and a gamer standpoint. So his observations were that paper money appears to be frowned upon, while plastic and metal coins are preferred for their dexterous feel. Then he also mentioned how some games like Lords of Vegas would have been improved if poker chips had been included as opposed to paper money. All right, let's hear what everybody has to say on this topic. Paper versus coins versus chips versus metal versus punch board. TC, what do you think?
Well, I think you're an idiot if you like paper money.
Well, I happen to agree with that. There's only one exception, and I'll mention it later, but go ahead.
No, I think that's all I have to say. But no, I'll elaborate. Like the paper money thing is something from that's like a holdover from like before when it was, I guess, cost effective and it didn't necessarily matter. Right. If you look at any like the Hasbro games and anything that comes out on like mass market and stuff, they will throw at you as much cheap stuff as they can, because if they can get away with it, then they can do it. And nowadays, you have a lot of these board games from the hobby market that are eclipsing the quality of, like, by far, eclipsing the quality of games that you can pick up at, like, Target or Walmart or any of those things, like, from Hasbro. And Hasbro is now trying to catch back up and go back to some of the stuff, like, I mean, the 80s stuff, where they just had plastic pieces, because they can totally do plastic pieces.
It's mind-boggling, yeah.
Yeah, but even today, you will still find, like, Monopoly with paper money, because they still haven't figured out that paper money sucks. and when you play Monopoly, you're like, oh, I get money. But that's why we all play with poker chips instead. Or,
well,
like,
it's also why you never want to be the freaking banker.
Yeah.
Not only the math, but having to separate those paper bills. Ugh.
Well, I always destroy them as much as I, like, crinkle. You get handed out and you crinkle it. Well, yeah. I'm serious. Like, so that you don't have that problem. You just crinkle up the money a little bit or do a corner, and yeah. But it's frustrating.
It is a problem.
It's a problem, and it's a holdover from like the 70s.
Oh, absolutely. Well, earlier than that.
But it's,
yeah,
all about, it's all about how inexpensive they can make a game, and it's much more inexpensive to make a game with really, really light paper money, because then you can put out Monopoly and sell it for $4.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's kind of the big point, though, is it is a holdover, like, especially a game that has a lot. I mean, we're talking about a lot of currency, and Monopoly has a lot of currency. Monopoly is kind of the exception to the rule, because yes, it's had paper money for thousands of years, because it's been in print for, you know, since about 800 BC, I think. And back then, all they had was papyrus, so we can't fault them for that. Yes. But anyway,
it came across from China.
Yeah, it was a variant of Go, and anyway. Monopoly just stayed that way for thousands of years.
They better not make Monopoly Go. They have Pokemon Go. If they make Monopoly Go, I'm checking out. I'm just turning off my phone and throwing it against the wall.
Aren't they doing a Broadway show? Monopoly?
Is it called Monopoly? Really?
Something.
Oh my God. Okay. Well, we'll keep our eyes open for that and let you know more about that. Anyway.
It'll be as good as the Spider-Man musical.
Oh, God. Okay, so anyway, but paper money and Monopoly makes sense for the game itself, because there are literally tons of denominations, and to include something other than paper money for that particular game would be cost prohibitive. It just would be. But then there are other games that have multiple denominations and currencies that you might use that have done it otherwise that might be cost prohibitive, but it turns out maybe it's not. But before we go into that, Jessica, what are your thoughts on paper money versus other currencies? Although, but first, though, TC, what is your preferred denomination type?
Oh, denomination. Well, I was going to get in. So basically, I really like my favorite coins that. So my favorite coins have been the metal coins that I got off of the sci-fi hegemonic coins.
You use that in every prototype.
Yeah, and yep. I carry it around with me, that little bag, and I use it in everything. And I didn't think at the time that I would be using them so much, but after I bought them, I just love them, and I use them all the time for everything. And I wrote a note to myself because one of the things that I've always wanted to do as far as a Kickstarter, like on my own or with help from other people, and I always thought this would be awesome, is to provide tokens. Punchboard tokens that you can put into either prototypes or games that have lesser quality coins and not spend, like, I think I did it with a friend, but still, like, the total for that money was like $50, something like that.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, TC, because Dan Patrice and I have actually had a motion in plan for about a year now to do something like that. So you can get on board with us, and it's not punch board, but it's going to be like, it's going to be plastic card.
Oh, I know. Yeah, but you told me about that, and that's fine.
No, it'll be awesome.
But I'm telling you, like, I can put 18 sheets of punch board into a small USPS mailer, all shrink wrapped and everything, and it all fits, and it'd be nice, and you get different artists to do different types of currency, and then you would just have these little punch board tokens that were inexpensive that you could use, and they look cool.
You could do the same thing on plastic art.
I guess, but then it's got a little plastic edges.
You want the nice soft punch board edges.
Yeah, it's so, okay. So nice.
I can buy that. All right. Do you want 2 millimeter or 3 millimeter?
I have to double check to see what the millimeter is of the ones that I checked out.
Okay, all right.
But I think it's 3. And honestly, it's just if I had to choose, though, like as far as those coins, it's like I don't need metal coins in every single game that I buy. I just really like the cardboard tokens that are, you know, circular or shaped. You can even shape them because punch board is amazing. You can do whatever you want, and it's cool. Like what did I have? Like the little, even the tokens from like Orléans or I don't know. All these games that have the little tokens, punch board tokens. I love punch board, little punch board currency tokens. I think they're awesome.
I have to agree with you. I like punch board currency myself. I mean, we've got a couple of Dice Hate Me Games products that have punch board currency. I can't even say that right. And like even the networks that has their little bundles of cash that look like, you know, big fat stacks of bills. I think that's just fun.
Yeah, but I understand where you're coming from. You have a little, you have your, if you have the laser cut pieces of plastic, you can put them right back into the plastic.
You can punch them right back in, and it's really more a holdover of using those as it's a bonus, because then we can use them as basically, well, I won't call them magic, but collectible card games or trading card games or living card games markers that can be done in different styles. Then we've already got that die cut. Then you could immediately do that with currency, and then you have multiple uses for it. So. But yeah, I agree with you. Like, punch board feels good. It has good tactile feel.
It feels good, and you, like I said, you have 18 of those sheets to work with. You can do as many different artists and different types. It'd be awesome.
It is true. It's very true.
Anyway, so that's my Kickstarter coming circa 2017 sometime.
Awesome.
So back it when you get a chance.
All right, Jessica, how do you feel about currency?
Well, in the 1 year that I've been gaming, I've only played one game that had paper money, and that was Imperial when we played it in PressCon.
Oh, yeah.
And I kind of liked flashing all that cash around and counting through it to see how much I had to deal with. But really, I like metal coins. I really think back to when I was playing Raiders of the North Sea, and they had these cool Celtic-looking metal coins, and they were just so chunky and clinky. I loved them. And, I mean, I like cardboard chit money, too, little tokens. But I don't know. I just like the feel of metal coins.
All right. Well, I mean, you said the only one you've played with plastic, with paper money is Imperial, but you've played Monopoly.
Yeah, but even the one play Monopoly had this year was with ATMs.
Oh, that's right. They came with credit cards. Yeah, you got your little cards.
Yeah.
That's not the same. I mean, as much as I hate paper money and Monopoly, I loathe paper money. But it's like, okay, well, it's just like in real life, it's like, it's not real money. It's like, oh, just, you know what? I want to buy a Park Place. That's not real money. Let's just charge it. You know, bleh, and you're done. When you're actually giving and you're counting out and you see like, okay, I have $50 left after I buy this place. You're like, I don't know. Don't want to do that. You know, I mean, you see it. So
I guess, but Power Grid is annoying with money. And also, the Lords of Vegas thing, going back to Lords of Vegas, like, it says it would have been improved if poker chips would have been included, and that is totally true. I'm trying to think of if I've played Lords of Vegas without poker chips, and I don't think that's the case.
I have.
And every single time.
I have, and it is definitely improved with poker chips. I'm going to tell you flat out right now, anything is improved with poker chips. And I know that you deal with them a lot, but I love chips.
They're good. They're good for stuff. I move them all around. I can do a stack of 20 in a second. So it's good.
So as far as I'm concerned, it's like not everything's going to be improved, obviously, with poker chips, because there are certain games that are just more thematic to play with certain things. I do agree with you, TC, that is, for the most part, what I prefer are punch bird currency. I like games that are thematic with their currency, you know, whether it's, you know, some space buck or a certain type of coin that's in punch board, things like that. I think metal coins are cool. I like them as upgrades. They're not something that I've specifically sought to go out and get. I mean, I've gotten some samples of things. One of the most favorite currency pieces that I have that I actually put in either my prototypes or support or supply for my games are these little wooden mini poker chips that I got from Meeple Source. And they come in different denominations, and they're a great size, and they feel awesome, and they have their screen printed on pieces of wood, and they're really cool. I like those. They feel good. They're nice and tactical. But, I mean, a lot of my favorite games have had punch board currency. Arkham Horror, a classic example, you know, Eldritch Horror, things like that. A lot of Fantasy Flight games have punch board currency. The only game that I give a pass to with paper currency is Firefly. It's the only game that I've really found that actually has good feeling currency that actually feels like real money. It's on decent card stock. The art on it's fantastic. So it's really thematic. It feels good. So I give that pass to Firefly. But it's the only game that I've seen with paper currency that I do give a pass to. Otherwise, though, I like chips. They're fine. Some people, of course, go freaking nuts. I'm just going to mention Splendor because they're like, oh, the chips and Splendor. So good. Anyway.
They're plastic, and they have a little bit of, like, the shininess.
They are. I mean, they're fantastic. They really are. But it just depends on the game. And I do like using poker chips sometimes with certain games, especially if it's, you know, relatable to the actual currency itself. Another currency that's often overlooked that I think is actually pretty good too is playing card currency. There are certain games like Vegas that uses the actual cards themselves as pieces of currency, and they're easy to hold. You can display them, you can put them in front of you, they're easy to move around. So I don't discount that use, which is come across in several games as well. So actual playing card.
What about currency. Plastic gems?
Hey, now, every now and then, plastic gems are cool. As long as you can keep the denominations simple and easy to count up, they work out pretty well. Yeah. So anyway, what we're saying is when you produce a game, don't put paper money in it, please.
Unless you have a really, really good reason.
Really good reason. If you have, like, you know, you have to count out $150,000 in 16 different denominations, sure, maybe paper money is the way to go. But overall, you
probably not make that game.
You probably shouldn't, because Monopoly already exists. All right, let's move on to the next one. This one was submitted to us by Lance Coffee and said a bunch of show topics, and one of his topics was to discuss the best games to play with your aunt and uncle who are in town after having not seen you for 10 years. I don't know, 13 years. I don't know why I said that. But
I think Lance Coffee is a fake name, by the way.
It is. Yeah, I think it's totally a pseudonym. So basically, if you have family, let's say your aunt and uncle, who have come into town, they have not seen you in 10 years, and if they hadn't, why not? And but we won't ask that question. So basically, he said this could apply to any family you haven't seen in a while. What games?
Well, I said that because I was going to talk about my dad.
Oh, well, that's perfect. Okay, so what games might you want to break out with family you hadn't seen in a while you think that would be accessible to them? We're assuming that they're not gaming family, but if you haven't seen them in 10 years, you never know. What games would not only facilitate discussion, but just be fun to break out and reconnect? So, TC?
I just gave games. I don't know. One of my I'll just go back to that. But one of my favorite games to teach to people, just to watch and see how they react to things. And I think it's not a great thing for after 10 years, but who knows? I don't know. I think I can play this with anyone, because people I haven't seen for 10 years is like anybody. So I would go with Coup. I think that's like my number one. It just because I like teaching the game. I like the bluffing aspect and all those other cool things that are going on. And it's just, I don't know. It's an easy game to understand once you understand that you can do pretty much anything you want.
It's so true.
Like you can lie, you can bluff. And I think for most groups, especially if you're getting together with family, you're going to have a larger group, and Coup really does well with like 5 players. So if you're going to have 5 players, and if you need the expansion, you can drop the expansion in there and then you can have more players. But I still think I prefer like 4, 5, 6 players with Coup, and that seems like a good family thing. I also put the requisite Hanabi code names and the game on there, because people just who are non-gamers just really eat up that the game.
They do.
Over and over again, I see that.
Yeah, and I think that it's also not only is it easy to play, but you're also with the cooperative aspect of it. You're working, you know, it's a safe environment. At the same time, you want to bash people's heads in when they play stuff, because you're just like, maybe you want to do X and they do Y. You know, it's like, you know, oh, what are you doing? But other than that, it's still a safe place where you're trying to beat the game itself. And I think a lot of co-ops facilitate that type of thing.
Yeah. So I think basically I give you Coup, a game where you want to kill each other, or the game, a game where you want to work together to kill each other.
Yeah.
And kill each other.
I'm down with that.
The process. So I guess either way, that's perfect for family time.
Either working together or wanting to kill each other.
Yeah. Yep. No matter what, you want to kill each other.
That is family. Jessica, what do you got?
Well, with this question, I immediately thought about my dad. For one, I haven't seen my dad in way too long. It's been like 7 years now. But we used to play games together when I was a kid, but they were just games like Uno. We played Uno a lot, but we also played Hearts. And so I think my dad really likes trick-taking. And I feel like if we had found gaming as a hobby when I was young, like we would be even closer than we are now. And he's the closest I am to now. But I feel like if I saw my dad again, I would totally introduce him to a bunch of games. But some of the first ones I would introduce him to are games like Diamonds. You know, and Skulking, since it's my favorite, I really think he would dig them. And especially with Diamonds, there's a little bit of take that with the stealing and stuff. So, which I think he would get a kick out of. And but since he knows the mechanic, then he can kind of easily get into the game. And then I could introduce him to more games after. But I would definitely go Trick Takers with him. And then also Codenames, I think, is a good one that would be good with him. He's good with words, and it'd be kind of cool. I think it'd be a bonding thing. Just kind of, you kind of see how people think when you play games like that with them.
Yeah, I mean, I think Codenames made all of our lists. And, of course, it's one of those that we agree is a modern classic now. It's just so easy to break out with different groups. And sometimes you have hilariously mismatched teams.
Yeah.
And now we have Codenames Pictures as well, so people just want to play around with pictures. I don't personally recommend Codenames After Dark or whatever it's called. with your family, unless you have a particularly warped family, and maybe you do.
Ex-in-laws would have loved it.
We're not here to judge. Play whatever you want with your family. but
Poopy 3.
There are certain families that I know that might probably have a good time with that game, but I'm not going to play it with my mom. I'll tell you that right now. But Codenames is definitely one that I had on my list as well, and I think that we could all recommend. And most people out there listening have played Codenames and will probably break it out with family. Also, if it just facilitates this, and I mean, if you haven't seen somebody in a long time and you want to kind of have a group experience, you know, Codenames is a good icebreaker. It relaxes everybody. There's a lot of laughter. I would say anything that facilitates laughter is good. I put on mine Wits and Wagers because it just, you really get down to the nitty gritty, the personalities of people, depending on how they bid in Wits and Wagers versus what they also guess. Because some people are just ridiculous in what they guess. Telestrations, because nothing facilitates laughter more than Eat Poop You Cat. I mean, it's just a great kind of facilitator for that as far as icebreakers. And also, not only that, but seeing how people's brains work. So, And generally, unless you play Telephones Against Humanity, you don't have a lot of really dirty stuff coming out. So Telestrations,
I still have to do that. I still so that puts it on my list of things to note down in my notes that I need to make a Telestrations deck.
Yes,
post it onto BoardGameGeek because I am just so sick of not playing Telestrations with a deck that works.
I agree. I think that playing the original parlor game of Eat Poop You Cat, where everybody kind of comes up with their own phrase, is always, at least in my opinion, a little bit more fun than Telestrations. But if people aren't used to playing a loose-based game and you break out Telestrations, it's probably a little more structured. Not quite as hilarious as some of the other ones that people come up with, but I agree with that. Yeah. Also include any social game, really, I guess, as long as you're playing intelligently and relaxed with people. If you have relatives that in the past you remembered are particularly nasty or competitive, some of these might not work. But I put the resistance down, of course. And then I said, if you really want to get caught up and reveal their very souls, then you gotta, of course, have to break out Lifeboat or Dead Last. Dead Last is a good way. If there's a lot of tension in the family, and you're wondering where the source of that tension is, you break out Dead Last, and the first person that's dead is the source of that tension.
that's pretty. That's good.
Yeah, that's a little bit of psychotherapy advice from me to all of our dear listeners. So Dead Last can help you suss out a lot of problems, and then you can all sit around and talk about it. Anyway, I think those are good suggestions. Maybe. Not all of them, but anyway, I would be fascinated to watch that behind a two-way mirror. All right, let's move on to the next one. This is the one about getting better with age. This is an interesting question. Joshua Jones wanted to know if there are any games that have gone up in our estimation, either with passing time or with repeated plays. And then we added in just a little bit of that, of what's the opposite of that. So in other words, what has gone down after repeated plays in our estimations. TC, start us out.
Okay, so I've said it before, I think, and that's Vegas Showdown is the biggest example for me in my gaming career of something that went from maybe just, I don't think it was hate, but it was just definitely annoyance to enjoyable and actually really enjoying the game. And so Vegas Showdown is one of those games that I just played the first time. I didn't get why anyone liked it, because it was just like, it's a very simple auction game. You're taking the pieces that you get and putting them onto your personal player board to create a casino. And it sounds fun, making your own casino, but it in play, just the component, I think it was possibly the components too. It's just like paper folded was your player board. and all the pieces had no art on them.
Right.
I don't know if you've ever seen the game.
This is an old Avalon Hill release, right?
Yeah, it was Avalon Hill. And, like, the guy on the front cover just looks so... He's in a suit. And he's like,
oh, he's totally game show host thing, dude.
Yeah. And behind him is this fictionalized Las Vegas that looks like cartoon... it's one of the worst productions ever. And I think all of that... I think all of that together made it just so flavorless and so boring to me on the first play. But after maybe four or five plays, I just really started to enjoy it. And I think it was just because I started enjoying the mechanics of placement of tiles and auctions and all the stuff that was in the game, which just made it better and better. So it just, I don't know. Other examples, though, Motanai. It's a really good example of a game that you have to play more than once, or you might not ever play it more than once.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, too, because I almost put Glory to Rome on my list because I love that game, and the more I play it, the more I like it. And Motanai is reimagined.
And both of them are in the same boat. And I think this is the question of, like, it's the Fallout Boy question.
This ought to be good. What's that?
this whole question is based on the idea that when you hear a song or an album the very first time, you might not enjoy it, but after a few repeated listens, it could become the favorite thing ever. And there is a Fallout Boy song that has those exact lyrics in it, and that Fallout Boy song is in the first Rock Band, and it was. And I play expert drums. I'm trained drummer, so it was like I played expert drums on that and got stuck on that song. And then during that time with Rock Band, in the first Rock Band, once you got to a song, you had to beat it to progress to the next set of songs. And I hated the song. It was absolutely infuriating because it was the hardest. It's probably the hardest song in the game to play on drums. And it was the worst song. Like, by far. So I had to power through it and hear those stupid, annoying lyrics every single time. And I will tell you this. I enjoy drumming. But, man, do I almost have to, because the drumming part is so good. The song, however, is so bad. It's just this bit mix of just terribleness that I just can't. Oh. So, but every time I open up Rock Band again, I will play the Fallout Boy song because the drum beat is so fun. I just have to, my brain hurts, though, from it. So, yes, that's that. And then also, I think we talked about this a long time ago, but that was Fleet. Fleet took me 2 plays. The second play, I liked it. First play, I don't even know if I liked it.
Yeah, the first play was interesting.
Disregarded it.
I mean, that was with me and you and Sherilyn, and it was, we both all sat there and went, what did we just play? And, I know you, definitely you were talking about it, and I mean, after the first, I took the shrimp route, which I usually do, which has become classic. In the first game, I took the shrimp route, and we were all like, "Man, is shrimp overpowered?" And then we played it again. We're like, "No, shrimp's not overpowered." So the more you play a Fleet, the more you get the nuances. That's definitely on my list as well because I mean that game just does not get old, and the more you play it, just even with different people, it just shines. But yeah, I agree with that totally. We'll get to our opposites here in a second. Let's talk about the positives. So Jessica, what about you?
Well, first of all, TC, I didn't know you were a drummer. That's so cool.
Yeah, well, that's me, and that's all the
and
secret
it's
stuff.
Totally hot
about my life.
Whoa, no.
Drummers are the guys that get married in the band.
It's true.
So just keep that in mind. I'm a long term kind of guy.
Okay, so I've only been gaming a year, so it actually took me a long time to come up with anything for this. But and none of these games are games I didn't like the first play. They're just games I continue to like more and more the more I play them. So one was the game Thurn and Taxus. And I got introduced to this game at RuthCon this year, and I really liked it and was hoping that I could get another play of it in. And thankfully, we got some new members in our game group, and they had it, and they bought it when we played it, and now that I'm gaming online, it's online on Yukata, and so I've been playing it a lot. And I love this game so much. I could probably play this game every day. It's so good.
I never get a chance to play that game, but I would like to play it again.
It's good. I like it.
And see if I actually like it or not, because I only played it one time, I think.
What did you think of it?
I really liked it. I just never got a chance to play it again.
Yeah, that's fun.
I didn't own it.
I like, because of the way the cards come out, you kind of have to change how you're going to play each time in terms of if you're going to go for, putting post offices in all the different regions, or if you're just going to try to get all one region and stuff. So I just, I don't know, I like it a lot. And then the other one is the game Creo that I got at Gen Con. The more I play it, the more and more I like it. It's just fun and trying to really get to the point where you know the game enough to play it in the true spirit of the game and then try to add in the new stuff. Definitely, it's a positive for me. It just gets better and better every time I play it. And I think the people I play with feel that way too. They always want to bring it out when we get together. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. Thern and Taxis is one that's definitely on my list to play. It's always, it's, people mention it as a classic, of course, and it's just never hit the table for me. I don't know why. Maybe I just missed the window on Thern and Taxis, but a lot of people mention it. On my list, mine is similar to Jessica's. I don't know. There's one game that is a classic example of something that I played the first time, two times, and didn't like it all. Thought it was just, what kind of game is this? And then went back and revisited it a year later, and I was like, what was I thinking? This game's pretty good. It was Burger Joint, and it's an interesting choice because it's a two-player game, and it's a basically pulling stuff from bags and creating combos. And I don't know what it was, but the first two times that I played it, it just kind of fell flat for me. And then for whatever reason, on a whim, picked it back up and played it again, and it was great. And so every now and then, you know, if you don't like something, there might be a part in your life where, and we've talked about this on previous podcasts, but there might be a time in your life where something just doesn't work for you. And if it's something, yeah, obviously there's a lot of games out there and you can't always give everything a second chance, but sometimes when you do, you're surprised. Everything else on my list, though, are pretty much classics that started out pretty good but have gotten even better with age. It wouldn't be a podcast if I didn't bring up Isbahan. Everybody take a drink. Because, I mean, we can't go through a podcast with an Isbahan reference. But it does. It literally gets better every time. And it changes depending on the people you play it with. And it's just solid. It's just so good. It gets good. I think, honestly, Stone Age is one of those that you can break out. Like, well, we just played it recently at PressCon with you, Jessica, and to introduce it to you. And it's still fun. I played it with Daryl and Leslie not too long ago. It's just one of those that I think is stands the test of time and continues to get better, especially when you introduce it to more people. And most of these are classics anyway, and I basically said that they're classics. They're classics for a reason, because the games that you really consider classics are when you can break out and are still good, or sometimes even better than you've played it before. Alien Frontiers falls into that as well. There's Arkham Horror, which has hit the table more than any other game in my collection. And Arkham is one of those that the more you play, the more you understand the nuances of the actual system and the combat system and whether you want to risk battling something. And it is an old school game. It's not for everybody. Some of the systems and rules are a little bit convoluted, but if you can get past that, it's what I feel like really benefits repeated plays. Firefly, I think, gets better and better. Fleet, of course, we mentioned. And here's one, a little off the beaten path, but I think Divinare is a underappreciated gem that gets better every time you play it. Because the first time you play Divinare, and TC, you can probably back me up on this, but the first time you play Divinare, you don't quite understand how cutthroat it can be.
Yeah.
But it's not really mean-spirited cutthroat. It's just the system of the game and the way it's built. And the more you understand that portion of the game, the more you're able to hedge your bets and to understand when things are coming, when you can switch like what your guess is in a certain area versus what somebody might hand you later in the game. And I think it's one of those games that with repeated plays you get better and better at. And there's not a lot of games that are like that. So I highly recommend Divinare for people who have not experienced Divinare, but definitely playing it repeated times to understand those subtle nuances that are part of the metagame of Divinare. That
it's got the Japanese microgame feel. You play it once and you're like, I don't know, and then you play it a second time, third time, fourth time, and then it just gets better as the session goes on. And yeah, I've had people just every time I'll break it out, I'll have somebody later on from that same group go, hey, what was that game we were playing the last time? They don't really ever remember the name, but they usually remember the game where I was making predictions, like, where is that game? And that's always a good sign when people ask for it, even people who play a lot of games. So.
Yep, I agree. I think it's fantastic. I don't even know if it's still in print, to be honest with you.
That's gotta be.
It's gotta be. It's just a really good game. So I would recommend going and checking that one out. And, of course, Pitch Car. Pitch Car is just fun.
Well.
Well, nothing.
That, that doesn't get better or worse. Just
it's just Pitch Car. That's right. It's just great all the way through. Absolutely right. All right, so let's talk about our opposites, and then we're not going to be dwelling too much on the negatives, but there are certain opposites. TCs are interesting because they happen to be all, well, not all, but most from the same designer. Go ahead.
It's all Richard Garfield time. I keep saying This is weird. I'm saying a lot of but I think I'm tired. That's why I'm saying a lot of this time.
Well, you're making up for Daryl being not being on the podcast.
Yeah, I'm making up for Daryl. Sorry. So, Robo Rally and Magic were on my list of things that went opposite directions for me. When I first played Robo Rally, I bought it because I was like, this is cool. You can play with eight people. There's all these different boards.
Oh my God, don't play with eight people in Robo Rally.
I don't care. It was just the promise. I bought it on the promise that you could.
Back in the day.
You could still do it. Yeah, it's still fine, whatever. Okay. People die, and it's whatever. But I'm telling you, like, once you do it once, you never want to do it again. And that's Robo-Rally, right? Robo-Rally has this promise of all these cool things that could happen. But in actual play, you'll play it one time and go, that was really neat. And then you'll start going, well, what else can I do with this? And all it does is add more length to the game. And it's
true.
A game that is probably two times too long for what it does. And every single time you want to have like multiple checkpoints and stuff to try to get to because it makes it interesting, or use all the boards, and you ever do that and you will never play Robo Rally again. And so so Robo Rally, and then Magic the Gathering, again, just one of those games that I played the heck out of it and then I don't want to play it anymore.
Yeah,
there's
Magic
other
has
games
this,
that are better.
Magic has this bell curve to it. It's like Magic is one of those special games where you're like, you discover it and you're like, oh, this is the greatest thing ever. And you play it. And then you reach the top of that bell curve and you're like, oh, this is not getting better. And you go down and you're like, I'm done. And then like maybe 2-3 years later, they go like, well, what about Magic? And you go up and it's not as high as the other one is. You go up the bell curve a little bit and you realize, oh, this is no, I can't do this. And go back down again.
I just recently played one of the new, because it was Lovecraftian, right? The Shadows of Innistrad, I think is what it was called. And my friend Tim, we were playing a lot of Japanese CCGs lately, and he broke out the Magic. I played it, and I was like, dude, I remember why I don't like this. Because we played a game, and it was just completely one-sided, and then it ended, and it's kind of one of those games where Magic can happen like that, and you're just supposed to play again.
Right, right.
And I remembered that from a long time ago, but then I was just like, dude, that's just not how modern games work anymore. You don't just play the game and go, well, I lost by a lot. I couldn't get the draw I wanted. But let's play again. It's like, you just don't do that anymore.
It's true.
It just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So it just made me realize that like games like Hearthstone and stuff have kind of mitigated a lot of that random card draw stuff that kills what Magic is. And then I don't know what it is about Richard Garfield games, but they kind of follow that same thing. And who knows, maybe I would feel the same way about Netrunner, because I really enjoyed that when I played it just a while ago. And I was like, oh, I should get into this. And I have this feeling that as I would get further into it, I would start disliking it more. But anyway, the ant game was the other one on my list. And it's not necessarily because I dislike it. It's just that I really had a positive outlook on it when I first played it. And the reason I think it was because I never had got to the end game. And ever since I've played a full game, you've lost and you still have to play the last round. Like that, I think the two other times I played it to full, like to the end, we had at least one person that was out and they still had a round left. Like, just because you know, there's no way, if everybody plays reasonably, there's no way you're just going to come out of nowhere and win. It's kind of just, there's no catch-up. So, yeah, because of that, and because of the deterministic aspect of, like, just ending the game, I kind of don't like that there's no exciting ending to Mirror Maze. Even though it's a really cool game to play, the ending is just kind of lackluster.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I'm just not... I wanted to like it better than I did, but after I've played it...
I love
it,
the pheromone trails.
Well, that's cool. It is it is cool, but it's also, like, the more you play it, you think, oh, the better I'll get, and, like, maybe I can get way up on these, like, bonus levels. No, no. I still understand how anybody ever gets further up.
You just have to get the right dice rolls, and I realized that after a while, but that's okay. I still enjoy the puzzle of the game. It just, you almost just have to go, okay, it's... It is a independent scoring challenge with a tiny bit of interaction.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I would agree. Jessica, what about you?
Well, I could only think of two that were ones where I played them, and then the more and more I played them, the more and more I hated them. One was Kemet. The first time I played the game, I actually really liked it. I won, but I realize now when I look back that I straight up turtled that game. I just stayed, you know, kind of, you know, meek and mild, and nobody fought me, and then everyone was battling each other, and then all of a sudden I won, and they realized, what happened? Where'd she come from? So the next time we played, everyone was attacking me, and I hated it, and I have not played it again. So
was
that,
it the same group?
Some of the same people. Okay. Not all the same people. Right. But, and I mean, they weren't all just ganging up and attacking me, but there were more, there was just more battling that had to partake in, and that game is what I think what made me realize I do not like games with combat in them. So Kemet, definitely, for sure. And I have not played it since then because of that. And then the other game is Spyfall, and I played Spyfall.
I got to witness the downgrade of this.
Oh,
one.
Yeah, he saw every second of it. Yeah. So cause every game of Spyfall I've ever played was played with him. The first one I was like, okay, you know, and then I played it again and I was like, Then I played it again, and I'm like, ugh. And then I played it again because we went to another big game day, and they wanted to play, and so I only played because they were doing it. And after that, I was like, no, never again. Never playing this game ever again. Ugh. Stupid Spyfall.
That's so funny, because technically in Spyfall, you could just say, I was wearing a... Like, you could just ask the most generic questions and, like, give a really fake answer and never have to think about it.
No, I don't like that. I hate that. I like, like, more defined stuff.
It's way too open-ended for her.
Yes,
no,
but
I know. Okay, I see what you're saying. I'm just saying, like, if you got forced into playing it, you could just be like, yeah, I rode my motorcycle here. hey, why are you wearing that shirt?
I would just say, what colors make you think about this place? I'll just say that every time.
How do you feel
what
about
what colors do
you
associate
place?
With this
what
location?
What TV shows would we watch at this location? Yeah, it's just... Yeah, Spyfall's a little open-ended. All right. It's a shame that you don't like Spyfall, but it makes sense. The only opposites for me... I mean, you know, there are certain games you'll play once. You're like, eh, that's not really my game. Or you might play twice. You're like, eh, that's not really my game. But there are some that keep coming up that people either love or they want you to play... For me, it's Power Grid.
Which is a great game.
Oh, I know you were going to say that because it's like one of your... Because it's your jam, dude. You rock at Power Grid.
Apparently. I don't know why that is, but... Yeah. It's like a math puzzle that I was getting. See, I don't know if I haven't played it in a few years, so I don't know if I'm still that on top of things.
You'll have to test that out with somebody other than me because I... Yeah. You just said it right there, math puzzle. I'm like, yeah. Please, Lord, shoot me now. Anyway, yeah, Power Grid, I know it's a classic. It's just people love it to death. I've played it. I've been roped into multiple games of Power Grid, and I have literally hated it more and more every time I've played it. It's a great production, and it's just a solid game, and people love it. It's just not for me. I just can't do it. I'm sorry. Guildhall.
You should be sorry.
Guildhall is another one of those that I'll say that, you know, I was like, oh, the first time it was introduced, like, yeah. And I hate to say this because people love Guildhall. Maybe it's simply the fact that every time I played it, I play it with more than two people. And everybody says, oh, you should play a two-player. Well, they make it a two-player game. But it just lasts like an hour longer than it should. And I don't know. And maybe I should give it another shot. They have the reintroduced ones with the new, and I got the review copies from AG, which I do want to play. I'm going to give my due diligence and play this with Dan. But I want to try out the new big box that they have with the different types of Guildhall that play a little bit differently than the original one, but I just can't. The original one just, I can't even. I don't even know. So.
Too long.
Yeah, it's just too long. I'm sorry. some games are just too long. There might be others that have kind of lost a little bit of sheen over the years, but, you know, for the most part, anything that I... And right now, I'm staring at my A-team shelf. Anything on my A-team shelf is there for a reason. So, they every now and then, they'll get pulled and put into purgatory, but it's rare. I'm still cataloging some stuff, so there may be some that are pulled and put in there. Other than that, though, let's move on to the next question. This is the one about kids' games. And Michelle Jones wanted us to talk about what makes a great kids' game and which are most fun for adults. Now, unfortunately, we don't have our resident expert with us, Daryl. If some of you may remember him from podcasts last year. but we can talk about because a lot of us do play games that are typically aimed toward kids, but we think they could be played with kids. And of course, all of us have played, you know, like either with, you know, family members or friends that have kids too. So, what games, what makes a great kids game and which are most fun for adults? So TC, what do you think?
Well, I just put that my most fun one that I've played so far is Igloo Pop. And I know that Matt Riddle and Ben Pinchback don't agree anymore, but
crazy.
I don't care about their opinion.
That's right. Igloo Pop's amazing.
I don't know what that is.
Super fun. It's we've talked about it before, but on here, but I'll go over it. It's, you have igloos that are little plastic igloos, and inside each igloo is a number of beads from 1 to 13.
They're not beads, they're Eskimo babies.
Eskimo babies. Eskimo children are inside of these igloos. And so, because we are all Yetis, we have to pick up the igloos and shake them to see how many
Eskimo babies
are inside.
Oh my God.
Not come out that are in there.
No, not come out. How many are hiding inside? So we pick up the igloo, we shake them. And the idea is, like, the only rule is that you cannot look at the bottom because the bottom is what reveals the thing. So you do have, you know, if you catch someone cheating at this game, though, you can punch them in the face. That's the rule. because you shouldn't cheat at this game because it's so stupid. But the idea is you pick up the igloo and you shake it by your ear, and everyone just, it's real time. So you grab an igloo real fast, shake it. Oh, there you go.
How many's in that igloo?
I'm going to go with
7.
That sounds like 8.
So that's your final guess, TC, 8?
Eight is my guess.
And what are you, Jessica?
I said 7.
7. Jessica wins at 6.
Oh,
man.
Close. But there
that's
you go.
That was my first guess. That was what I was going to go with. Anyway, no, but that's what you do. But you put them on cards then. There's cards in a ring that give you either direct guess, like it might be 8 or 10 or 11, right? You can put it right there, and it's totally an 11. And anyone can put their igloo anywhere they want. You can double up on cards. It's not like once I put my igloo on a certain card, you can't. But you go by, so like some will have 2 numbers, some will have 3, and some will have 1. And you just place your igloo on that thing. And once everybody, all the igloos are placed, or there are any igloos left in the middle because they don't think the cards match with any of them, then you look at the cards and you reveal the igloos. And there's, I can't remember what the tiebreaker rule is if you have 2. I think it's like the highest number wins. But if you're within that range, you take the card and you score some points and then you keep going. But if you lose, you lose like a thaler. And whenever one player runs out of coins or thalers, then the game's over. And I really enjoyed it. I mean, for me, it just never outstays its welcome. And it's fun to like try to be, it's fun to listen to do something that you can't be really good at this game. So it's fun to just be like, yeah, that's totally 11. Throw it on the 11 exactly and get it right, because that's just super hard. But I think that's the reason why that works well for adults and kids at the same time is because it's quick. It like only takes like a few minutes, like 5 minutes to play this, or maybe 10 minutes to play this game. So it keeps your interest. It's raucous, so like kids are enjoying their time just as much as the adults are. And again, it evens the playing field really well. Kids and adults can count, any kid that can count from 1 to 13 can play this game, and they already know how to play once you tell them how to play. And I think the same thing happens with, like, Rhino Hero, too. And that's, like, dexterity games, I think, also help bridge the gap between kids and adults. Because Rhino Hero, you just stack some cards and a rhino up on a tower, and it gets bigger and bigger, and then eventually it'll fall over. But it's fun because anyone can play it, and it doesn't, and your skill level is not necessarily dependent on your age. So anything that can bridge that gap is really cool. I think the best thing is the kids games that I hate the most are games where you kind of talk down to the kid or make it educational for a reason. Those are my least favorite kids games, because it's like, we're gonna play a game called Counting Turtles, and it's a counting game where a kid has to remember how many turtles are underneath something, right? I don't like that because I can't play it as an adult and have fun, and the kid is not necessarily learning much. They're just learning that they don't like memory games, and they'll learn that later in life.
Yeah. Didn't take me long, but yeah.
But yeah, I avoid specifically educational games for kids. I really like games that are exploratory, dexterous, loud, raucous, or require everyone to be involved at the same time. I think all those things are great for kids games, and I wish more kids games were like that, but the problem is people just make bad kids games. There's a lot of them.
Yeah, there are. Then I mean, it's like, I mean, there are some classics.
Talking forever about kids games, but
what's that?
Sorry. I'm like going on and on about kids games forever, but yeah, I wish there was a lot more games that you could play with kids and adults and have the same sort of experience. So.
I agree with that, and you know, you see, there are some classics, of course, that people will play with kids, but it makes a difference whether you can enjoy it as an adult as well. And I think that's what makes a good kids game, because other than just saying, "Okay, kids, sit down and play Candyland together," you know, I mean, as an adult, sure, you might humor your kid and play Candyland, but you're not going to really have fun playing Candyland other than watching your kid have fun, which is always good. But let's be honest; I mean, we're humans; we want to have some fun too.
It's not even a good lesson. It's Candyland is the exact opposite of what you want to be teaching your kids. And
well, it teaches pattern them recognition. Thing. That's about it. But
that's it. Well, color recognition. Or it teaches you whether or not they're colorblind.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, that's true.
But
I agree with what you said. That number one, you got to keep everyone at the table engaged. I think there should be raucousness and laughter involved, because that makes sure that everybody's having fun. Because even if the kids are doing something stupid and you're an adult and you're watching it, you're having fun with it, you're laughing.
It induces laughter, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what a really successful kids game. Jessica, do you have something to add? Do you have games that you would suggest for kids? Or?
Well, I'm not around kids much, and I don't have any and don't really know much about kids. But in terms of being an adult playing some kids games, I've played a few. And for me, like you're saying, anything that induces laughter is great. My favorite kids game is Gas Out, which is a farting cloud. And farting just induces laughter. It doesn't matter who it is. And it's silly and dumb, but it's just, it makes you laugh, and everybody has fun when you're playing with little kids and big kids.
I don't think flatulence is humorous at all.
Yeah, right. And then, like, Rhino Hero. So for some reason, stacking things, for me, induces a lot of laughter, just because it induces giggles when you're afraid that it's going to topple. And that just anticipation is a lot of fun for kids and adults, I think. And I saw, when I was at FeldCon, I saw this older guy playing, or he was like his late 20s, but playing with some little kids. And he was playing Lift It. And I'd never seen that game played, and that was kind of cool because it's...
Oh, that's the thing on your head, right?
Yeah, so with your head, and there's some dexterity in there too, and there was giggling amongst them too while they're playing. So anything that induces laughter, I think.
They're like Pie Face.
No matter what you're doing. Yeah, exactly. That the anticipation, you know, that worried that the pie is going to hit you in the face is just... It just induces... Just like with the anticipation of if the gas cloud is going to finally fart on your turn. You know, it's just... Well, it just makes you laugh and makes everybody laugh and have fun.
It's universal human experiences, no matter what the age is. And I think you're right in that anticipation of that dexterity thing where you're not sure if it's going to topple or whether you're pressing your luck, pulling the trigger in pie face where you're going to get a face full of, like, whipped cream. You know, it's like that sort of thing transcends age.
Yeah.
And... I think they create, and even dexterity games, like, you know, Haba creates some great ones that, you know, like Monster Tort and stuff like that, where you might play against kids, but the kids have probably just as much a chance of winning as you do, because unless you have really, you know, trained, you're an Olympian of grabbing a marble with a spatula, you're not going to be like, or a wooden spoon, you're not going to like totally cream a kid. So those types of things that, and like Igloo Pop, the whole nobody, unless they have like bionic ears, are going to be able, well, that's six Eskimo babies floating around in there. And the whole conceit of the game is ridiculous to begin with. So as an adult, you're not like, well, I'm going to take this game 100% seriously. And the kids are like, oh, no, I'm not. Because you're all going to be like goofy playing the game and just having a good time. So I think that it's mostly finding a game that's loose enough that kids will. And that's not to say that some of the other games that are out there that have more structured rules aren't good for kids, but it's mostly an experience playing the game as much as it is mechanically going through the actions of the game that I think makes a good kids game.
We didn't even talk about like role playing games or like, you know, the story dice.
Oh yeah,
Rory story cubes. And yeah. What's the Extraordinaires? Which I think the Extraordinaires, I don't know if you've heard about that, but that's the Rory Story Cubes guys created a workshop for creativity.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
It's just this almost like a briefcase for kids that's filled with like storyboards and just different ways to interact and create things based off of prompts. So like you have to create a movie script and like and do all these and do like storyboards for it based off of like these certain criterias. And the way that it works is just really fantastic, and it's great for like older kids. And then what about like, oh, and little kids, like stuff like Go Away Monster. I always think it's Go Away Monster. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite ideas for a game. Honestly, I think it's really simple and ingenious and empowering to children. And it doesn't feel like an educational game, but it totally is.
Yeah, well, anything,
and it may not be fun for parents in that sense, but that's for really little kids. And man, I don't think you're gonna find a kids game for really little kids that's gonna be fun for adults.
Yeah, I think for the most part, you're probably right, but there could be. I mean, but storytelling, as far as like getting into storytelling and hearing, especially hearing the stories that kids come up with, is fascinating.
Yeah.
And I think that's a lot of fun. And that's why I still think your Soft Red Cube is the way to go, dude.
I've got the prototype on the desk right now.
Do you really?
We'll see. Yeah.
All right.
But we'll see what happens with
that.
We
got to get that thing going, man.
That thing's
amazing. And the Extraordinaires is better than playing the Aristocrats with kids. So, for anyone out there who knows what the Aristocrats is.
Never know.
Probably not a good idea. Okay, so final question and very, very important one. So the one not related to games at all. This is from some fat kid on Twitter. So Ben asked us what our favorite mac and cheese add-on is. So TC, what is your favorite mac and cheese add-on?
Well, I think it was white chocolate.
White chocolate? On mac and cheese?
I had white chocolate mac and cheese and it was great.
What?
I did have a really good crab macaroni and cheese at a place, but I still think the white chocolate macaroni and cheese was the best.
I don't even imagine what that tastes like.
I know.
What do you mean? Come on. Okay, so have you ever had like I remember I went to Red Lobster a while ago and got one of the contest winners from the Food Network. I forget what show that was.
Probably the best cooks best cooks in America or something like that.
I don't even know.
Yeah.
But it was one of those, you know, it's like, oh crap, you have no cheese and you gotta make whatever. I don't know. But someone won a contest with like this like white chocolate and coconut like halibut or cod or something like that. And at Red Lobster, they decided, hey, we'll put that out. And so I went there and got it and was like, this is amazing. And then since then, just something about the mixture of like the salt and the sweet really gets it on that. So yeah, yeah. So I don't know. Yeah. So yeah, try it.
Well, that is an unconventional answer. Chocolate. Yeah.
Do it.
Wow. Yeah, I don't. I mean, sweet and savory mixed together sometimes can be good, but it depends. And I would never have like sea salt and caramel. Like, you know, that's pretty good, but cheese and white chocolate. Wow.
Yeah.
We'll try caramel and mac and cheese.
My next trip to the grocery store, right there.
That might work.
It might. It might.
Maybe.
Yeah. All right, Jessica, what's yours?
Come on. It's got to be bacon.
Bacon? Yeah, I knew it was coming.
I love me some bacon.
Bacon goes...
Bacon on anything.
Anything. Bacon goes anything. Good together with sweets, too. Like, if you have maple bacon and stuff.
Donuts, maple bacon donuts. We should start a food podcast.
If a donut doesn't have anything inside, it's no good for me.
What? What?
You have to have filled donuts?
That is complete hyperbole, but I'm going to stand by it anyway.
I used to love like a strawberry jelly filled donut, but I don't like filled donuts anymore.
What? You know, I like lemon and I like custard.
Oh, custard donuts. Those are good.
My dad used to always, my dad still today, this day, thinks I love Boston cream and I hate it. But it's just because I love anything with strawberries on it, and everything Boston cream came covered with strawberries, so I always got it for me. But I couldn't
Boston
tell them that I hated
cream
Boston
cream. Have strawberries on it?
Strawberries?
Yeah, Boston cream pie with strawberries all over it.
How do you what? That's not a Boston cream pie. Who would do that?
I was always in California. Maybe that's a thing in
California. Yeah, it's with California, dude. Do you ever tried the Boston cream pie lately? It's like got like strawberries on it.
Man, I wonder if a donut filled with white chocolate mac and cheese would be good.
No.
I'm going to order that next time.
Well, my favorite mac and cheese add-on is lobster. And I had some fantastic lobster mac and cheese up in Boston. And it was fun. It didn't have strawberries on it either. It was just, lobster. But also, I had a lobster bacon mac and cheese up there, which was a freaking amazing. Four cheese, lobster, and bacon macaroni and cheese. Anyway. Okay. So, yeah, I'm now I want mac and cheese. Great. Thanks. Now I need mac and cheese for dinner.
Oh, man. That does sound good.
Well... Sadly, we have come to the end of the podcast. We're going to go into the backside now. Let's start out with notable Kickstarters. And two of those I have mentioned, and of course you can learn more about those on the latest Geek All-Stars, but Merchants of Araby is currently on Kickstarter. That is, of course, by our friends at Daily Magic Games. And it is definitely a game for gamers who love negotiation, because that is pretty much all the game is. Although I will say that Eric Booth was able to play it without really negotiating. Not only play it, but win it without negotiating a ton. So the other notable Kickstarter that I will talk about that I talked about before was Unfair. Once again, you can hear more about that on the Geek All-Stars, but Unfair is currently on Kickstarter. It's over $100,000 right now. Wow. And $49 with free shipping to the U.S. and Canada and a couple of other places. I think Australia is one of them, because Good Games, who puts out the game itself, is based in Australia. Again, really solid game, fantastic production, great artwork, but if you don't like Take That, probably best to avoid that.
This is probably a pretty game for me, and I hate it.
You probably would, but you would play it. Does anybody else have any notable Kickstarters they want to throw out?
I'm not allowed to look at Kickstarter.
You're not allowed to look at Kickstarter?
Nope.
Well,
not right now. I might get back to it. For next podcast, but.
Well, I'll go ahead and throw out then for Dice Hate Me Games news that you might want to check Kickstarter in a couple weeks, because we're going to have the expansion for Isle of Trains up on Kickstarter. That is Isle of Trains All Aboard. And it's called All Aboard because it has passengers and it has a board. So, super cool.
And it's got all the changes that I said that should be in there.
Absolutely. Every single change that TC said. Isle of Trains has done really well for us. It's got a big fan base. We hope that a lot of people will come out. It's going to be a pretty low funding goal, so and a pretty short campaign. I think we might only run it for about 2 weeks. But come out, because you get a bigger box, which you can put your original Isle of Trains into. If you don't own Isle of Trains, of course, we'll be selling that with the campaign as well. You get a board, you get new cards, which include passenger cars, passenger engines, you get little meeples of passengers that you can load onto your trains to deliver to certain depots. around the island. And then also you will have certain buildings that will give you in-game scoring based on passengers and depots and things. So come on out and check that out. Of course, we'll have some more information on the next State of Games about more details on that. But that is going to be, I believe we launch on September 6th. Let me see what my calendar is here. September 6th, I believe, yes. So check it for September 6th. Of course, keep your eyes open for Spires, which will be sometime a little after that, third or fourth week in September probably. Mm-hmm. So keep your eyes open. That, of course, we'll have more information and more definite dates about that on the next podcast. That is not by Dice Hate Me Games, by the way. It's Nevermore Games, but it's TC. So we want to give time for that. The other Dice Hate Me Games news is that, speaking of TC, he's currently working on changes to Viva Java, not necessarily rules changes, but rules clarifications, some updates for the files. We're going back to print with Viva Java and Viva Java Dice. We hope to have Viva Java Dice here and ready to sell by the holidays. Viva Java will probably be a little bit later, but those are definitely coming up for your second printings of both of those with some revisions. So we'll keep you updated on all that. TC's going to lock himself away and not go to work for a week and do all that, right?
Yeah, I'm just going to... Well, my plan was today, but I think I'm tired today. So tomorrow...
That's fine.
I'll be working hard on the Viva Java changes. But yeah, it'll just be... I basically want to just take all the things from the FAQs that people had, the little questions, make sure they're back in there, which means changing a few wordings and stuff. And then... if there's anything else I can do to just make it so it's like clearer.
Yeah, we're not changing like any of the formats as such. Well, we're making the rule book for Viva Java Dice bigger. We're also getting rid of that stinky smelly bag that everybody didn't want in the first place for the first edition.
yep.
Yeah.
And we'll see behind the scenes. I have something to talk to Chris about, which he'll absolutely hate, but we'll see it. See what he says.
All right, we'll figure out. We'll see what that is. That ought to be interesting. The only other Dice Hate Me Games news that I have is that I will personally be at Grand Con in Grand Rapids, Michigan, September the 16th through the 18th. So if you're going to plan to be there, you can look for me. We can play games together. I will have a copy of Fate of the Elder Gods there with me if you want to try that out. Richard Launius will also be there as well, so I'm sure he would be more than happy to sit down and play with you. So come on out to Grand Con, say hello, and we can hang out. We can be friends. Daryl's not here for Unpub news, so Unpub doesn't exist. It's dead to us. I don't really know of any Unpub news coming up, to be honest.
Unpubs, go to the minis. Make your own minis.
Right, exactly. Will there be, I guess there'll be Unpub presence at WashingCon.
Yep.
Yep. So that's coming up about the same time Grand Con is, or the weekend before possibly, but yes, it's the weekend before. So if you're going to WashingCon, I believe there will be an Unpub presence there. So if you have prototypes you want to take to that particular convention, you can go there and check that out. And then after that, the only other thing that I know that's coming up is going to be Unpub Mini around Jessica's neck of the woods in October.
In October, yeah. And it'll be in Midlothian, the same location as last year, the Battlegrounds.
All right. So we'll have more on that on the podcast as we get closer to that. Anybody else have anything they want to announce before we move on?
Well, I will be at that board game thing convention around the same time that you're at Grand Con, and that's the 14th through the 18th.
Right. So you'll be in my neck of the woods, and I'll be moving on. So,
yep.
Well, y'all have fun. Hey, I can't make it again this year, but I'm sure you'll have a good time. All right. Well, that's it for this episode of the State of Games. We'll be back next time with more great board game discussion. Of course, just like with this podcast, we used a lot of your suggestions. So if you want, we want to hear from you, and we want to provide content that you want to hear. So please send us ideas for show topics you'd like for us to cover and new segments you'd like to hear. You can email your ideas to thestateofgames@gmail.com, and you can tweet us at @thestateofgames. You can also go to dicehateme.com and comment on the podcast, or join Guild 1903 on BoardGameGeek.com. You can also hit me up on Twitter at @dicehateme. What about you two?
I'm at Puppy Shogun on Twitter, and I also do other things on the internet, so check me out.
And on Twitter, I am at @FeldFangirl, and you can find me with my segment on the What Did You Play This Week podcast thing.
All right. Well, until next time, this is Dice Hate Me.
And this is Puppy Shogun.
And this is FeldFangirl.
Saying thanks for listening, and may all your rolls be
sixes.
That wasn't too bad.
That was terrible.
But before we get to that, what's everybody been up to?
Such a weak segue. Hey, my name is
such
PC.
A weak segue. You're a weak segue.
Hey, before we get into anything else, what is this other thing?
What's this other thing that we need to talk about?
So, my name's TC, and I...
which all the game is. Although I will say that Eric Booth was able to play it without really negotiating. Not only play it, but win it without negotiating a ton and just maximizing his card play. So, for your benefit, Jessica, you could play the game and let everybody else negotiate for you.
I'll try anything once. Anything once.
I hear that. Anyway, there's another joke you can cut out. So.
Oh my gosh, Christopher!
I hear that.
Sorry, I had to.
I'll do anything three times.
Oh my gosh, we're getting deleted.
This podcast is out of control. Okay,